Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Hey, Johnny.
Hey.
You still here?
Still here, man.
Got a minute to talk?
I suppose I can fit you in.
All right.
Well, we're really concerned about the tenor of the prosecution's questions. We're really bothered by the way they go after certain jurors. You know, ultimately, it's an issue of fairness.
Now, fairness for whom?
Well, you have eyes and ears. You tell me.
This is total bullshit.
Well, so what? I'm not worried about whether it's true. I'm worried about perception.
The optics.
Yes, the optics. With Cochran taking a larger role, I think it might make sense for us to balance out our tickets, stir in a little added flavor.
You mean a black person?
I didn't say that, Bill, but it's not a bad idea. Add a third share. Sure, give our team something extra.
We like where we are.
Uh-huh. Well, I think you should strongly consider what I'm saying.
What about Chris Darden?
Unbelievable. And I'll tell you, you know, I'm watching this case, and they get this black guy up there.
Chris Darden.
Looked like he just got out of law school. Yeah. Sounded like he just got out of law school. And it was clear the only reason he was there, because he was black.
There was no reason.
No reason.
For him to do opening argument.
The guy was awful. I mean,
I was trying to follow him, and he kept repeating the same thing over and over and over again.
He was like, he sounded like Tom Schizano, you know, would be a lawyer. He started out
into control.
Now, you got to understand
controlled
something.
Controlled Nicole.
They have a great case. The prosecution has a great case. Oh, everyone knows O.J.'s guilty. But you got to get up there. If you're going to be a lawyer, you got to razzle dazzle.
Yeah.
You got to have a little bit of showbiz. You do. You got to be able to say, you know, it's almost like giving a eulogy. You don't even have to present the facts. Let me tell you what an opening argument is. You don't even have to present the facts so much. What you have to do is get people emotionally involved. Show those pictures of the headless bodies. Get lots of blood going. Ron Goldman's dad broke down and started crying when they showed the picture.
Nicole Simpson was glaring at O.J. the entire time the opening arguments were going on, and at one point did break down in audible sobs.
Yeah, that's good. And you got to make people cry and feel emotion. I mean, you can't stand there like a robot.
That does not compute.
But it was clear they brought in this guy because O.J. had a whole bunch of blacks.
I don't know why they brought him.
Oh,
I wouldn't
man.
Oofa.
Where'd they get this guy from?
He's always worked there.
Darnell.
He didn't know where the microphone
Darnell,
was.
Darnell? Yeah. His name is Chris.
Oh. Wasn't Darnell?
No, it was Chris Darden.
Darden, that's it. That Darden was his first name?
No. But the one thing I find very...
Let me give my opening argument.
Wait a minute. Just let me say this.
All right.
Every time they mention one of these black guys, they got to tell you what a superior lawyer they are.
Yeah, right.
Like, you couldn't... If they are superior, they'll show me.
Right.
You don't have to tell me every minute.
Yeah, well, every minute they're trying to tell you that the guy's got, you know, credentials and stuff. So, anyway, the prosecution brought in their black guys. Now, first of all, when... in most of these cases, what they do is... You got to understand something.
What?
Like, most of the prosecuting attorneys are not real good attorneys. If you're a good attorney, you go into private practice where you can milk and bilk at $400 an hour so that you can rob from the rich. So what they do is they have a prosecuting attorney. In most cases, what they do is they bring in somebody called a special counsel, they call
right.
it. Special counsel means they go get a professional lawyer for you.
Somebody else who's outside of the system who's really, really,
really
good.
Really good. But I'll tell you something. This Marcia Clark was pretty good.
I didn't think she was great either.
She did okay. She was boring, but she did all right. She presented the facts. The black guy started out good. Don't get me wrong, but he droned on. He's got to think of himself more like a minister or a preacher.
He talked for what, an hour,
right.
hour and a half,
right.
and said the same thing.
Yes.
OJ was under control.
You got to play on the emotions. You stand up. like Perry Mason, and you address the audience. The audience, of course, the jury.
When he was sitting there and he was saying, he slapped her. He humiliated her. He beat her.
Man.
He talked about her in public. He called her fat when she was pregnant, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, yeah. The whole thing's a joke. Well, I'll tell you something. And then, so they haul in this black guy to give the opening statement. They all didn't put everyone to sleep. Marsha Clark could have done the whole damn thing.
Yeah.
But they had to have, you got to march out a black guy. Because if you look over in O.J.'s corner, now you can't even find any white guys.
Well, wait a minute. O.J. has so many people, they didn't have enough room for the audience to get in there.
That's right.
That jury pool is on one side of the courtroom, and O.J.'s lawyers take up the other side.
Right. I saw so many people. That F.U. Bailey sits there, and Johnny Cochran, and there's a new black guy.
Another black guy.
A bunch of black guys. Yeah, Robert Shapiro.
I saw two black guys, Johnny and that other guy.
Yeah.
And then there's a couple of others.
Well, everyone's trying to pile black guys in. You're telling me now, in order to have a trial, you got to pile black guys in.
Oh, come on. You resent black people having jobs, don't
Bull.
You?
Bull.
Why can't they get some of the money?
And then they bring in this guy... And the guy's name is Black Guy.
What black guy?
That's how she introduced him. Marsha Clark got up and said, by the way, this black guy is going to talk to you so we can show we have a black guy. What's his name? Black Guy. Just call him Black Guy.
Prosecution Black Guy.
Press number one. Press it's like a basketball team of briefcases. I never saw such an opening argument.
Well, you know, I resent you too saying they only have these lawyers there because they're black.
Well, come on. It's crossed your mind too. No, Johnny Cochran is a very competent lawyer. From what I understand from his reputation.
These other guys.
Come on.
There's only one, Howard.
No, this guy they brought on the private. Marsha Clark was doing a bad job.
It was really sad and stupid.
Thank you.
It's a disgrace to the black jurors that they think they can't win this case unless they are being argued before by a black man.
Well, that's true. You know that.
Stop that.
Well, that happens.
Warning.
You know what? It's funny because I think after those opening statements, though, a lot of black people are now going to have to give up on that O.J.
Do you think there are any black people left that still... John, go out on the street.
We need another survey.
Listen to what I'm going to do. Take a break. Scott, get a microphone out on the street. Ask black people if they still think O.J.
After they saw that trail of blood.
Right.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, January 14, 2021. So I have been told, wow, don't feel like I need to say a whole lot. We are really primed and ready to roll. The book club, this is Jeffrey Toobin, Zoom bomber number one of 2020. His New York Times bestseller, The Run of His Life, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. This is our eighth installment. We are picking up on chapter 13. We could just go right now. All the audio that you just heard, that is exactly where we will start at. The first segment, that was a brief snippet from the 2016 FX series. That was episode number four, 100% Not Guilty, where Johnny Cochran's character rather is saying, hey, we got eight black jurors, and now they come up with a black person. And then you hear the prosecution, Gil Garcetti, telling Marsha Clark and Bill Hodgman, maybe we should add a little extra flavor to our team, Chris Darden, a black person, a delectable Negro. And then after that, we heard a nice sampling. That was the Howard Stern Show. And that's why I said it's such a great times capsule, because that is like exactly January 25th, 1995, to the date in the O.J. Simpson trial. So you can hear exactly what they were talking about as events were unfolding. And racial showcasing. Darnell. We can't even get his name correct. Don't we talk about that on Neutralizing Workplace Racism? Darnell. And even we got a man now. This, you can't get up there and be some robot. And they gave you the robotic sound effect, the man knot. Dr. Kevorkian, I think, would appreciate that one. And then Carl Douglas is the other black male that they were referring to who is a part of the defense, Johnny Cochran, and Carl Douglas, who we will hear a lot about today. As I said, we should be ready to roll. Chris Darden, welcome to the narrative. And I'll just encourage folks to remember Jeffrey Toobin in this book. When we started off, he said that the prosecution lost because of arrogance, mostly Marsha Clark, and incompetence, mostly Christopher Darden. Keep that in mind, even in terms of how Christopher Darden came to the team in the first place, and then everything that unfolds as we begin officially the people of the state of California versus Orenthal James Simpson. Whew, so excited. In fact, we will even kick off with one more segment from the FX series, Johnny Cochran's character again addressing how exactly did we end up with Mr. Darden on the prosecution. The Cal's audio segment one.
As you know, the O.J. Simpson trial will start soon. And we want to pray with our member and friend, Johnny Cochran, who is litigating the O.J. Simpson case. Johnny, come forward. Let us pray. Lord, for this day we are thankful.
Yes, Lord.
For Johnny Cochran, we are appreciative. We pray for Johnny Cochran as he accepts this challenge to litigate the OJ trial. Yes. King Jesus listens when we pray.
Yes,
Lord. Amen.
Amen.
Now Jesus is on their side, too.
After the service, Mr. Cochran addressed reporters.
Of course we all know Mr. Darden is a fine attorney.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden he shows up now, after we've got 8 African Americans on the jury. Why is that? It's obvious to me Mr. Darden is being used as a tool by the DA's office because he's black. Thank you, honey.
Chapter 13. Blaming Faye. Christopher Darden paced in front of the jury box. As he walked, he kept his eyes on the floor, and his double-breasted jacket flopped open in front of him. Now, we're here today obviously to resolve an issue, to settle a question that has been on the minds of people throughout the country these last 7 months. It certainly has been on the minds of my people up in Richmond, California, and friends in Fayetteville, Georgia, and all across the country. Everybody wants to know, and everybody I know often poses a question to me. Did O.J. Simpson really kill Nicole Brown and Ronald Goldman? The phrase, my people up in Richmond, was not an accidental choice. Both the diction and the reference to the location came fraught with meaning. In general, white Americans do not refer to their relatives as my people, nor do they, for the most part, live in Richmond, California. The overwhelmingly black city near Oakland was Darden's hometown, and his mention of it marked a small effort at solidarity with the African-American jurors who were arrayed before him. Darden was nervous, as any person would be in his position. On arriving at the courthouse this morning, January 24th, the lawyers had run a gauntlet of 26 video cameras and perhaps twice as many still photographers. 7 news helicopters had circled overhead. Even the core group of spectators, The reporters and family members who had seen each other almost daily for several months took on a hushed, almost reverent attitude on this day. There was an important new face among them, too. Eunice Simpson, the defendant's mother. Tall and regal, even though racked by arthritis, appeared in her wheelchair in the courtroom's center aisle. As soon as Eunice Simpson arrived, Judith Brown, likewise a grandmother to Sydney and Justin Simpson, gave her a hug, hands fluttering nervously on her lap just before Darden rose to begin his opening statement. Judith Brown dropped her eyeglasses, and Kim Goldman casually leaned over from her nearby seat to pick them up. Retrieving Judith's dropped glasses had cost Kim's brother his life. That it was Chris Darden who began the case demonstrated how much the prosecution effort had evolved over the months leading up to the trial. Shortly after Simpson's arrest, Garcetti had asked Darden to conduct the grand jury investigation into the Bronco chase. At the time, Darden was at loose ends. He had been named to run the DA's Inglewood branch office, but he had not yet moved. Darden had an excellent reputation in the office as an investigator, less so as a trial lawyer, and Garcetti and Hodgman thought the grand jury role made sense for him. But as the scale of the trial expanded, particularly in the scientific area, Clark and Hodgman realized they could not handle it all themselves. Clark, an old friend of Darden's, urged that he be invited to join the trial team. The racial tensions in the case made the logic of adding Darden even more compelling. The case needed a black prosecutor. Darden's rise also reflected Don Vinson's fall. By late January, the results of Vinson's focus groups were a forgotten memory. The prosecutors had decided to make domestic violence evidence a linchpin of their case. From an early date, Clark and Hodgman had divided the labor so that Clark would handle testimony about the events of June 12, 1994, and Hodgman would focus on the scientific evidence. That left the ever-expanding number of domestic violence witnesses still to be assigned. Those went to Darden. And since the prosecution lawyers had decided they would attempt to prove that O.J. and Nicole's relationship provided the motive for the murders, it made sense for Darden to begin the prosecution presentation to the jury. In his opening, Darden went right to the heart of the prosecution's theory. The answer to the question is, yes, O.J. Simpson murdered Nicole Brown and Ronald Goldman. And I'm sure you will be wondering why as the trial proceeds on, and I'm sure you're wondering why right now. Why would he do it? Not O.J. Simpson. Not the O.J. Simpson we think we know. But that is another question. Do you know O.J. Simpson? We watched him leap turnstiles and chairs and run to airplanes in the Hertz commercials, and we watched him with a 15-inch afro and Naked Gun 33 and a third. And we've seen him time and time again, and we came to think that we know him. Here, Darden paused. What we've been seeing, ladies and gentlemen, is the public face, the public persona, the face of the athlete, the face of the actor. It is not the actor who is on trial here today, ladies and gentlemen. It is not that public face. Like many public men, they have a private side, a private life, a private face. And that is the face we will expose to you in this trial, the other side of O.J. Simpson, the side you never met before. When we look upon and look behind that public face, you'll see a different face. And the evidence will show that the face you will see and the man that you will see will be the face of a batterer, a wife-beater, an abuser, a controller, the face of Ron's and Nicole's murderer. Darden recited the litany of abuse in their relationship. Domestic abuse, domestic violence, stalking, intimidation, physical abuse, wife-beating, public humiliation. He said at one point, "Please keep in mind that all of these different kinds of abuse were all different methods to control her." And yet, the list of incidents, on close analysis, was rather thin. In Simpson's trial, the prosecution could point to only a single example of wife beating, the 1989 incident for which Simpson was arrested and then pleaded no contest. There were no other proved examples of physical violence between them. Nicole had referred to several more incidents in the diary she prepared in connection with her divorce proceeding, but Ito had ruled, correctly, that that document was inadmissible hearsay evidence. Here, the Simpson case illustrated one of the larger tragedies of domestic violence, that it usually takes place without witnesses. Still, with the district attorney having made the Simpson trial into a domestic violence showcase, Darden pressed on, even lapsing into a kind of California psychobabble at times. He stripped her of her self-esteem, Darden said. He was so controlling that he attempted to define her identity. He attempted to define who she was. Darden's theory even turned what others might call Simpson's generosity against him. Darden said with disdain that O.J. gave Nicole money. By the time she was 19, she was driving a Porsche. He got it for her. That, too, according to Darden, was evidence of his desire for control. Everything Darden said was probably true, but his opening could also be interpreted as a great edifice of rhetoric built on a foundation of little evidence. The prosecution's problem was exacerbated, of course, by the makeup of the jury, which was filled with people predisposed to admire Simpson and to discount evidence of domestic violence. Darden finished with the story of Sidney's dance recital on the night of June 12th. The prosecutor had picked up confidence as he spoke, and he now addressed the jury instead of his shoes. O.J. arrived late at the recital, bearing flowers for Sidney, Darden said, and he greeted everyone in the Brown family, except Nicole. Simpson moved a chair to the corner of the auditorium, and he sat there facing Nicole, and he just stared at her. He just sat there staring at her. This was a menacing stare, a penetrating stare. It was an angry stare, and it made everyone very uncomfortable. The Brown family, Darden said, had decided to have dinner at the Mezzaluna restaurant, and as they left, they made it clear to the defendant that he was not invited. And he wasn't invited. And by not inviting him, it was a reaffirmation of what he had already been told. And that is that it was over. He was no longer being treated as a part of the family. He was no longer the central centerpiece of every family outing. Nicole was getting on with her own life. And as the Brown family left, they looked toward the defendant, and they saw him. And he was angry, and he was depressed, and they were concerned, and everyone wondered, what is he up to now? Miss Clark, Darden muttered quietly, we'll tell you exactly what the defendant was up to as the day proceeded on. His conclusion was almost elegant in its simplicity. She left him. She was no longer in his control. He could not stand to lose her, and so he murdered her. Marcia Clark's style differed from her colleagues. Businesslike, almost chipper, she stood behind the podium and moved only when she had somewhere to go, as opposed to Darden's nervous pacing. She began by introducing all of the lawyers on the prosecution team, the traditional duty of the lead counsel, and that, in part, was her mission on this day. A good prosecutor commands the courtroom, orchestrates the case. She wanted to show the jury who was in charge. Darden had spoken without exhibits. Clark employed a series of elegantly integrated photographs, slides, and charts in her presentation. This in itself was unusual. Most district attorneys' offices cannot afford to give their prosecutors much more than a blackboard. But even though Clark had dismissed Decision Quest from jury selection, the prosecution did continue to accept the company's pro bono assistance in making charts and other visual aids. Decision Quest ultimately made hundreds of these state-of-the-art exhibits over the course of the trial, an effort that would have cost a paying client nearly $1 million. Picking up the story on the evening of June 12th, Clark introduced the jury to Cato, whose last name would scarcely ever be uttered during the trial. And she told of his trip to McDonald's with Simpson, which ended with their parting around 9:40 p.m. Her pace quickening, Clark turned to Nicole's movements in the hours before the murders. After the dance recital, Nicole and her family had dined at Mezzaluna. They returned home, and then, also at 9:40 p.m., Judith Brown called her daughter to say she had dropped her glasses on the sidewalk outside the restaurant. That was the last time Judith ever spoke to her daughter Nicole, Clark said. Nicole then called Mezzaluna and asked that her friend Ron Goldman, a waiter there, bring them to her house. He left for his home, and then Nicole's, at about 9:50 p.m. It was a very specific opening statement, with a multitude of times and places identified for the jury. This is risky business for a prosecutor, for an opening is nothing more, and nothing less, than a promise to the jury of what the evidence will show. Broken promises, even on relatively innocuous subjects, can embarrass a prosecutor, or worse. There was, in fact, no real reason to lay the story out with such precision. No jury could be expected to remember such details over the many months to come. But it was a measure of Clark's confidence that she thought she had the story so thoroughly nailed down. Clark's precision extended even to the animal world, that is, to the subject of barking dogs. At approximately 10:15 p.m., she said, Pablo Fenves, who lived diagonally across the alley behind Nicole's condominium, heard a dog begin to bark. A moment later, Clark even repeated the time, this time without the qualifying approximately. The dog barked at 10:15. Clark thus committed the prosecution to a theory of the case that had the murders taking place shortly before 10:15 p.m. As Clark knew even before her opening statement, other credible evidence put the time of the murders about 15 minutes later. Placing the murders at 10:30, or even shortly after, or better yet, leaving the time somewhat vague at that early stage in the case, could still have served the prosecution's purposes. But again, Clark's arrogance led her to an unwise commitment. Speaking with few notes, Clark gracefully integrated the disparate strands of the story. O.J.'s whereabouts were unaccounted for after 9:40 p.m., when he and Cato parted, until Alan Park, the limousine driver, saw him at 10:55 p.m. hustling into the house. During that period, Cato heard loud thumps outside, near the air conditioner, which was precisely where the bloody glove was later found. Never in her opening did Clark mention the name of the detective who had found the glove, Mark Furman. Even though it was a cool night, Clark noted that O.J. asked Park to turn up the limo's air conditioner as they raced to make Simpson's 11:45 p.m. flight to Chicago. She turned, at last, to the discovery of the bodies. Now I'm going to show you what Sucru Bustepe saw when Nicole's dog took him to 875 South Bundy, Clark said. And then she nodded toward Jonathan Fertlow, a junior prosecutor whose role it would be throughout the trial to control the video and slide projections on the large screen that was bolted above the witness stand. P7, said Fertlow, calling out the exhibit number. The photograph had been taken from the sidewalk, looking toward the stairway that led up to Nicole's front door. The young woman lay in a fetal position in a pool of blood. Clark had shown these photographs to the family members before, so that they wouldn't have to see them for the first time in the courtroom. But Judith and Lou Brown still shuddered, steeling themselves as they saw again the scene of their daughter's death. Clark then described how Officer Risk crept up the walkway, trying not to disturb the trail of blood, to a point where he was able to see that it was not just Nicole, but also Ron. P11, said Fertlow. The Browns, the parents and the three surviving sisters, heaved their shoulders as one when the photograph of Ronald Goldman came up on the screen. It was a far more gruesome image. His body wedged into the corner of the fence, his shirt pulled over his head, and his exposed torso, so muscular and young, marred by obvious knife wounds filled with congealed blood. Clark's words added to the horror. He was literally backed into a cage where he had nowhere to run, and that is how his murder was accomplished in a very short amount of time. A cage. The phrase was so awfully right for the place that Goldman had died. Clark next moved to a photograph of Nicole taken from the top of the stairs. Her body was curled, and no wounds were visible, but the quantity of blood was shocking. Clark turned now to the last and most powerful portion of her opening statement, the story of the blood. She offered a brief, homey introduction to the subject of DNA testing. Some of you talked about Jurassic Park, and they used DNA to make dinosaurs. And then she offered a preview of the results. Fairtlow put up the slides of the various blood spots. By the left door handle in O.J.'s Bronco. Matches the defendant, said Clark. On the center console of the Bronco. Consistent with a mixture of the defendant and Ron Goldman. The socks in Simpson's bedroom. The blood on one spot matched the defendant. The blood on another spot matched Nicole. Each one of the blood drops to the left of the bloody size 12 shoe prints, leaving the murder scene. Matches the defendant. Matches the defendant. Matches the defendant. Matches the defendant. And the results of the analysis of that blood confirms what the rest of the evidence will show, Clark said, that on June the 12th, 1994, after a violent relationship in which the defendant beat her, humiliated her, and controlled her, after he took her youth, her freedom, and her self-respect, just as she tried to break free, Orenthal James Simpson took her very life in what amounted to his final and his ultimate act of control. She then paused a beat. And in that final and terrible act, Ronald Goldman, an innocent bystander, was viciously and senselessly murdered. Shortly after Clark finished her opening statement, a producer for Court TV, which ran the camera in Ito's courtroom, advised the judge that the camera had accidentally shown the face of an alternate juror for about a second. A furious Ito said categorically, "I'm going to terminate the television coverage as a result of that." But in what would become characteristic of his style throughout the trial, Ito cooled off and changed his mind the following morning. No one enjoyed the attention more than the judge. The cameras could stay. He even praised Court TV for its candid acknowledgement of the mistake. Then he called for Johnny Cochran to begin his presentation for the defense. Cochran wore a periwinkle suit. Vertical white stripes ran the entire length of his tie. And there were blue and white vertical stripes on his shirt, too, to go with a contrasting white collar. Somehow it looked right, all that exuberance in Cochran's dress. He stood before the same podium the prosecutors had used, but he radiated a confidence that they could not hope to equal. Cochran's chest looked like it was ready to burst out of his form-fitting double-breasted suit. Anyone wondering what place race would play in the defense of O.J. Simpson had only to wait about 1 minute into Cochran's opening statement. The jurors, Cochran said, would hear a lot of talk about justice. Searching the jurors' faces, he went on. I guess Dr. Martin Luther King said it best when he said that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And so we are now embarked upon this search for justice, this search for truth, this search for the facts. Cochran then paused to pay tribute to the jurors. We are very, very pleased with the fact that you have agreed to serve as jurors, to give us your time, to leave your lives, to be sequestered, as it were. That is a remarkable sacrifice, he continued. Abraham Lincoln said it best when he said that the highest act of citizenship is jury service. Having enlisted King and Lincoln in the cause, Cochran went on to discuss parts of the case that Clark and Darden didn't talk about yesterday. He started with the tale of the maid who lived next door to Simpson on Rockingham, Rosa Lopez. On the night of the murders, according to Cochran, Lopez heard something very strange. She heard a prowler. When Lopez came out to walk her dog at 10:15 p.m., ostensibly the time of the murders, she saw the Bronco parked in the same place it had been earlier in the evening. From Lopez, Cochran moved on to Mary Ann Gurchis, a very interesting lady, who was apartment hunting on Bundy Drive on the night of the murders. Shortly after 10:30 that night, Cochran said, Gurchis was walking on Bundy, and she sees four men who come within 10 feet of her, two of which gentlemen appeared to be Hispanic. I think the others are Caucasians, several of which I believe have knit caps on their heads. The two who are behind apparently have something in their hands they are carrying. Cochran charged that these witnesses had been ignored by the police and prosecution. Cochran noted with disdain that Lopez had been interviewed by one Mark Furman. Detective Mark Furman will play an integral part in this case for a number of reasons. Now, it is very interesting that the prosecution never once mentioned his name yesterday. It is like they just want to hide him, but they can't hide him. He is very much a part of this case. We can only ask ourselves, why didn't they mention him? I think that answer will become very clear to you as the case progresses. And as for Gurchis, Cochran said she had called the police hotline about the case and was told, "Excuse me, I'm talking to a psychic right now, and I will get back to you." Cochran shook his head at the lack of respect for the very interesting Mary Ann Gurchis. But the treatment of these witnesses all fit into a larger pattern. This case is about a rush to judgment, Cochran asserted, an obsession to win at any cost and by any means necessary. Invoking Malcolm X's most famous phrase, by any means necessary, Cochran declared war on the LAPD. The case against O.J. Simpson, in other words, was really about the conspiracy to convict him. It was about something else, too. Like the prosecution's juror research, the defense focus groups had also found hostility among black women toward Nicole Brown Simpson. In his opening, Cochran gave the jurors every reason to reinforce their presumed predisposition to view O.J. as an icon and Nicole as a tramp. Cochran took issue with Darden's assertion that O.J. had exercised all this control over her and picked her friends. The evidence will show that Miss Nicole Brown Simpson is a very strong, independent woman. Cochran went on. She picked and chose her own friends. Neither O.J. Simpson or no one else could tell her who her friends were to be. She had whatever friends she wanted. She did whatever she wanted. Cochran then regaled the jury with tales of Nicole's fast life. Though nominally aimed at refuting the charge of stalking, Cochran ran through a catalog of her sexual exploits. Sex on a couch with Keith Slomzovich while the children slept upstairs. Sex with one of Simpson's best friends, Marcus Allen, though Cochran did not name him. One man sitting astride Miss Nicole Brown Simpson, giving her a massage or something in her shoulders. Miss Nicole Brown Simpson came over to the Rockingham house and said she had found a boyfriend, somebody different than Keith. But with these examples, Cochran was just warming up for his main point about Nicole's sordid personal life, that the sinister figure of Faye Resnick was at the center of it. "Let me say this about Faye Resnick," Cochran said gravely. "On June 3, 1994, her boyfriend, Christian Reichert, had thrown her out of their house because she was freebasing cocaine. They ran in this circle out there in Brentwood, and when she was put out on June 3rd, she then moved over and lived with Nicole Brown Simpson. Cochran implied that Nicole and Faye were doing drugs together. Because they were friends, they would go out at night. The evidence will be these ladies would go out 2, 3, 4 nights a week and stay out until 5 o'clock in the morning. Nobody was controlling these women. They go out dancing. They would do whatever they would do. And we know Faye Resnick was using drugs during this period of time. Cochran went on to say that Faye's drug problem got so bad that on June 8th, her ex-boyfriend and ex-husband forced her to enter a drug treatment facility. Cochran then said Faye Resnick was one of the people that called Miss Nicole Brown Simpson on the night of June 12th, perhaps after 9 o'clock, that particular night, from this drug treatment facility. After a pause, Cochran said darkly, "We will be talking about that and her role in this whole drama." Cochran's opening statement represented a bold risk. Most defense attorneys use their opening statements to remind jurors of the presumption of innocence, to urge them to keep an open mind, and to make as few promises as possible. A defendant in a criminal case has no obligation to put forward any evidence, and few defense attorneys want to commit themselves at the beginning of a long trial to naming the witnesses they will call to the stand. So what Cochran did was all the more remarkable. He made scores of specific factual claims about the evidence in the case, and described in detail some of the witnesses he would be calling. Cochran's supremely confident opening statement demonstrated how central a figure he was to the defense strategy. He became the very incarnation of O.J. Simpson, his voice for the jury. Cochran sought to transfer his enormous prestige in the middle-class black community to his client. On the defense team, only Cochran had the stature and the race to do that. There was another new player in the courtroom during opening statements, and he took an amused interest in Cochran's tale of the nefarious Faye Resnick. 5.5 feet tall and nearly as wide, Lawrence Schiller would become a frequent presence in the corridors outside Department 103 and in the 12th floor media center. Bearded, balded, shoveling endless fistfuls of M&Ms past his yellowing teeth, the 58-year-old Schiller represented an apotheosis of sorts for the O.J. Simpson spectacle, the perfectly amoral profiteer. Schiller bore a passing resemblance to the actor Zero Mostel, and he appeared in the Simpson case as the reincarnation of Mostel's character in the film The Producers, the man who tried to sell the public on a show called Springtime for Hitler. A one-time photographer for Life and other magazines, Schiller operated on the fringes of show business for decades and left a trail of multiple divorces, embittered business associates, and bankruptcy. Schiller specialized in exploiting an arcane and odious corner of the literary marketplace, the purchase of book rights to murderers' life stories. He made deals with Jack Ruby, Susan Atkins of the Manson family, and Gary Gilmore. It was, in fact, Larry Schiller's interviews with Gilmore and others that provided the raw material for Norman Mailer's masterpiece, The Executioner's Song. The only real surprise about Schiller was that he took several months to surface in the Simpson affair. Schiller even had a good entree. He was a longtime acquaintance of Robert Kardashian, and he had lived near O.J. and his first wife many years before. Through Kardashian, Schiller inveigled an invitation to visit Simpson in jail. As he later described it to a friend, Schiller told O.J., "You are a literary resource. You need someone who can exploit it, i.e., me." Simpson agreed, and Schiller came up with the idea of a book of O.J.'s responses to the many thousands of letters he had received in jail. With Kardashian's help, Schiller contrived to have his name placed on the list of material witnesses who were allowed to visit Simpson in jail. There were, ultimately, 52 people on this list, and many of them, like Paula Barbieri, were Simpson's friends more than potential witnesses in the trial. This arrangement is another example of Simpson's favorable treatment by law enforcement authorities. Schiller acknowledged privately that it was preposterous to suggest that he was really a material witness in the case, but the jail guards never challenged him, even when he began to lug a large, high-quality tape recorder into his meetings with the defendant. At his home in Studio City, Schiller used his personal computer to edit the letters and O.J.'s responses, and even to lay out the pages. As Schiller put it together, the book was almost comically sympathetic to O.J. In a chapter called Spousal Abuse, for example, the first letter to Simpson began, "Mr. Simpson, one thing I wanted to say, everyone is focusing on the alleged abuse you inflicted on your ex-wife. No one has mentioned the abuse she inflicted on you." Simpson responded to these letters with a series of banal pieties, most of them focusing on his supposed great faith in God. In fact, before his arrest, Simpson neither attended church nor showed any interest in spiritual matters in conversations with friends. Speculating about his life after prison, Simpson wrote, "I know that I will raise my children differently in relationship to God. Without a doubt, I can visualize it. I have already visualized each Sunday. I won't play golf. Sunday, we will go to church." Wandering around the press room, Schiller chuckled at the notion that Simpson's protestations of innocence might be true. His interest in the matter was purely commercial. In concert with his publisher, Little Brown, Schiller arranged for the book to be printed under false names at three plants around the country. Then, according to the plan, the trucks would roll up to bookstores just before Cochran was to begin his opening statement. In perhaps his greatest marketing coup, Schiller arranged for an audio tape of Simpson reading excerpts from the book to be sold at the same time. Schiller thought the tape itself might be profitable, but he knew that the news media would rush to give the public the opportunity to hear Simpson's voice, and thus give the book enormous free advertising. Schiller's plan worked to perfection. The book, called I Want to Tell You, was released a few days early, on January 7th, and it became an enormous success, selling more than 650,000 copies. As Don Vinson might have predicted, booksellers found that black women bought the book in especially large numbers. It wasn't just Simpson's obvious guilt that Schiller found amusing. He also scoffed at the notion that Simpson actually wrote or said all that was attributed to him in the book. One of the most quoted passages in the book came on the very last page. "I know in my heart that the answer to the death of Nicole lies somewhere in the world that Faye Resnick inhabited. According to Schiller, I put that in at the last minute." It was all, thus, part of a coordinated attack on Nicole, her lifestyle, and especially her friends. Ullman's elliptical hints about drug dealers, one of Cochran's opening remarks about these ladies who would go out 2, 3, 4 nights a week and stay out until 5 o'clock in the morning, and finally, Schiller's book. Through all these allegations, indeed, through the entire trial and beyond, not a shred of evidence ever surfaced linking any individual except O.J. Simpson to the crime. The defense never ventured an explanation of why drug dealers linked in some way to Faye Resnick would have wanted to kill Nicole Brown Simpson, much less Ron Goldman. That wasn't the point of the defense strategy. The point was to muddy the character of the target of this homicide. In the end, the reason for the defense's obsession with Resnick can be found in the focus groups. That is, in the overwhelming lack of sympathy that black women felt for Nicole Brown Simpson. The Resnick card was just another version of the race card, in this case, an outlet for the resentment of black women toward the blonde temptress who had snared this black hero. The remainder of Cochran's opening statement hewed predictably to the defense themes. He described what he called O.J.'s circle of benevolence, a phrase the lawyer used to describe the defendant's financial contributions to charity, which in fact were minimal, and to Nicole's family, which were considerable. He said that O.J. suffered from arthritis so severe that that on the day of the murder, he could not shuffle the cards when he played gin rummy at the country club. Cochran mentioned a dog walker by the name of Tom Lang, not the detective, who said he saw Nicole embracing a man on the street in front of her home on the night of the murder, as well as a man he described as Hispanic or Caucasian standing there looking as though he was angry. Cochran disparaged the work of the LAPD employees who had collected and analyzed the evidence, and he offered a brief criticism of the DNA evidence. At the same time, Cochran asserted that DNA tests, presumably reliable ones, proved that blood found underneath Nicole's fingernails was inconsistent with her own, Goldman's, or Simpson's. Finally, Cochran returned again and again to Rosa Lopez, the next-door maid, who would testify that O.J.'s Bronco was parked on Rockingham at the time that the prosecution asserted the murders were taking place. In all, Cochran mentioned Lopez's name more than a dozen times. It was, on one level, a remarkable opening statement. Cochran cited any number of specific witnesses who would directly contradict the government's theory of the case. If the defense lawyers could back up Cochran's claims, the prosecution's case would be shattered. But as it turned out, they couldn't. Indeed, they didn't even try. By the end of the trial, the defense would never back up any of Cochran's startling claims. It would never call dog walker Tom Lang to the witness stand. It would never call Faye Resnick. It would never even call Rosa Lopez, although she would indeed become a participant in the trial. The blood under Nicole's fingernails turned out to be her own. The reason Simpson didn't shuffle the deck of cards was because his friend Alan Austin didn't let him. Austin knew O.J. always cheated when he dealt. And Cochran's star witness, Marianne Gurchis, turned out to be a pathological liar who spent her life dodging creditors and who, shortly after Cochran's opening statement, would plead guilty to defrauding the Marriott Hotel of more than $24,000. Before Gurchis pleaded guilty, she claimed that an imposter using her name had actually run up the bill at the hotel. The defense would never call Gurchis either. In his opening, Cochran built a Potemkin village of assertions. There was nothing beneath the rhetoric. No matter, the evidence mattered less than what Cochran said it would be. He had planted the seeds. The LAPD was corrupt. O.J. was virtuous. Nicole deserved what she got. Cochran's opening statement was also an unethical piece of lawyering. California discovery law obligated each side to turn over to the other all statements by witnesses it planned to call over the course of the trial. As part of the discovery process, starting even before the preliminary hearing, the prosecution had given the defense tens of thousands of pages of material. The defense, in contrast, had given the prosecution next to nothing. This was not in itself highly unusual. The defense in a criminal case always generates far less investigatory material than does the prosecution. But as the prosecution continued to demand defense witness statements throughout the summer and fall and into the winter, the defense lawyers responded that they understood their obligations but had nothing to share. Then, during Cochran's opening statement to the jury, his majordomo, Carl Douglas, announced that he had found statements of 12 witnesses whom Cochran had suggested the defense was going to call. Many of these statements, including one by Marianne Gurchis, had been taken by the defense several months earlier. This discovery failure, as it is known, put the prosecutors at a real disadvantage, not so much because they couldn't prepare for Gurchis's testimony in the defense case, which would not begin for months, but because if Clark had known about Gurchis's claims, she could have addressed them in her opening statement. The news of the Gurchis statement blindsided Clark and her colleagues. The next day, Carl Douglas addressed the issue of the discovery failures by the defense team. Douglas made his living by keeping track of Cochran's schedule and making sure Cochran had the right file in his hand at the right time. When the center of operations in the defense camp shifted from Shapiro's office to Cochran's after the first of the year, it was Douglas's thankless task to untangle the files. Now, in his arch, almost archaic speaking style, he tried to explain that the withholding of the documents had just been an unfortunate mistake. "The court is well aware that we have been working diligently in this matter," Douglas said. "The court is equally aware that the work in this case has been divided among a couple of offices and investigators, etc. It perhaps is regrettable that I stand before this court, that we have not coordinated all of our defense efforts as well as I would have liked before this point. I say that because, Your Honor, I have some documents that I do intend to give over to the people. Your Honor, I acknowledge and I anticipate that there will be strenuous efforts to impugn both my personal integrity and the integrity of the defense team. I tell this court, looking the court straight in the eye with all seriousness, that it had been an oversight, and I am embarrassed by it, and I take full responsibility." Ito, who had been studying the prosecution table as Douglas spoke, observed, "I have to say, Mr. Douglas, I've had long experience with Mr. Hodgman. I've known him as a colleague, as a trial lawyer, and I've never seen the expressions on his face that I've seen today." The judge turned to the bearded and usually stoic prosecutor and said, "Mr. Hodgman, why don't you take a few deep breaths, and we'll take a look at this." Among his other responsibilities, Bill Hodgman supervised the discovery process for the prosecution. The disclosure about these 12 witnesses' statements came on top of the defense's disclosure one day earlier that it had a list of 34 new witnesses it planned to call during the trial. These were appalling violations of the discovery laws, and Hodgman felt personally wounded by what he regarded as a dirty trick. In the Todd Bridges attempted murder case, Hodgman had enjoyed a cordial relationship with Cochran. In a prosecution of financier Charles Keating before Judge Ito, Hodgman had likewise had the confidence of the court and his adversaries. As Ito observed, Hodgman now looked stricken. Shapiro noticed, too. When Hodgman rose to speak, Joellen Demetrius whispered to Shapiro at the defense table, "You know, Bill doesn't look too good." Shapiro agreed, then quipped, "Yeah, tomorrow they're going to take him out on a stretcher."
Context of white supremacy. OJ Day on the Cows, our first audio segment. We will pick up audio segment number two with chapter 14, Thank You, Carl. I want to make sure I get in before I forget the audio that we opened up with, the second audio segment where you hear Johnny Cochran saying that he thinks Chris Darden is being used. That is from episode 5, titled The Race Card. There is a chapter in the book titled The Race Card, but it doesn't match up exactly. Neither here nor there. That episode is produced by the late John Singleton. He and Cuba Gooding Jr., who plays O.J. Simpson in the FX series, reunite after all these years from Boys in the Hood, reunite for episode 5 of the FX series, which deals a lot with some of the tension with Chris Darden being added to the case, racial showcasing. So I will include Chris Darden's perspective on him being added to this case. We had a listener, I think, a couple weeks back who asked Chris Darden, was he used? How do we feel about Chris Darden in this case? Was he a victim? Is there some culpability for Chris Darden in all of this? I guess we can keep all that in mind as we're reading. Chris Darden got, like many, 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 many people involved in this case, also got a mega book deal that he got to, and I think a New York Times bestseller. So keep that, all of that in mind as we read. From said bestseller, In Contempt, Darden writes about how he was added to the O.J. Simpson case. This is what he says. So on October 18, I sat across from Marcia, her offer to join the case still hanging in the air. I glanced around her big office at the standard metal dividers that served as walls, cold and lifeless in other offices, but painted light blue and covered with photographs in Marcia's. This was clearly someone comfortable at work, unlike other people whose offices were merely the particular space they took up. This was a woman who took her job and herself very seriously, who invested everything she had. She sat curled up on her knees again, like a tough little package someone had left on the chair. She raised her eyebrows, waiting for me to answer. "It's a great honor," I said. There were more than 900 deputy DAs in L.A. County, and Marcia had chosen me for the biggest murder trial in decades, perhaps ever. She told another lawyer that she really didn't know how good I was until she'd read the transcript of the grand jury hearings in the Cowlings case, and that, she said, was when she knew I belonged on the Simpson team. She smiled at me and raised her eyebrows again. "Well? Okay," I said. "Let's do it." Marcia had intimated that I would present some evidence and handle a few witnesses, but when we told Hodgman that I had accepted, he seemed to go the other way. I would be in the background, cataloging exhibits, making sure witnesses were in court on time, coordinating investigators, and managing the junior members of the team. I was relieved. That meant no TV, which meant I didn't have to worry that every homie in Southern California would be wondering if I was betraying my race. That made my decision easier. As I drove home that night along the Harbor Freeway, a million headlights flowing like blood cells through crowded arteries, I knew I could change my mind. My father's words were still with me. Hell to pay. I might be hated and vilified in the black community if I got into that mess. Only a fool would get involved, I thought. Maybe I should say no. But why? Because I was black? I had prosecuted thousands of black men, black male privilege, yet no one had paid any attention to those cases. Where were the protests for those black men, black male privilege? Or did a black man from Inglewood deserve less support than one from Brentwood? No matter how idealistically I looked at this case, though I knew it was different, it had the potential to become symbolic of things the country wasn't ready to talk about, of deep, illogical prejudices that had nothing to do with two people murdered in Brentwood. Johnny Cochran was rarely subtle about his trial strategy, and it could be summed up in one word: race. Cochran was going to use it. He always did. If I allowed the awesome power of the specter of racism to drive me off the case, I would be validating their strategy, allowing it to work. Should I reject the case because of the evidence or the cops? I have turned down cases because I believe the evidence wasn't strong enough, and sometimes I have decided not to prosecute cases because I didn't believe the police officers who investigated it. But there was an abundance of evidence here, and the case seemed fairly well investigated. The LAPD hadn't done a perfect job, certainly, but its officers had gathered enough evidence to prove that O.J. Simpson was guilty of a gruesome double murder. Should I say no because Simpson was a celebrity and an icon in the black community? There would be incredible media scrutiny and pressure from black activists, but if there was one thing I believed, it was that nobody is above the law. Not the rich, not the police, not O.J. Simpson. No one. The laws enforced against the minimum wage earner in Compton should be the same laws enforced against the millionaire from Beverly Hills. If it is to work, the law can't succumb to the pressure of media or community. Nor could I. Still, I was torn. My responsibilities as a prosecutor clearly told me to take this case. But I had other responsibilities as a black man, and they were difficult to sort out. If I thought I was being named to the case primarily because I was black, I would have rejected it. It was as simple as that. But I knew that wasn't why I had been chosen. I was a strong litigator and an experienced DA who had a background in the case because of the Cowlings investigation, and I was floating between positions in SID. I thought about something else. Was I going to be seen as a brother putting another brother in jail? What did this say to the young black man watching from the outside? Finally, I hoped that young black man would be glad that there was a black man on the other side of the aisle. Perhaps it was naive, but I convinced myself that African Americans had to be represented in all segments of the law if we were to ever believe that the system was ours too. We have become used to seeing black police officers patrolling 77th and Southeast Divisions. We have become used to black public defenders and judges. But if we were ever to have real ownership in the system, we had to have prominent black prosecutors too. They would never really be our laws until we enforced them. Admittedly, the system was often unfair because of racial bias. That was unfortunate and at times criminal, but that had nothing to do with this case. Should blacks take themselves out of the justice system because it is sometimes unfair? Or should we work within the system to change it? This was a case about rage and obsession, evil and murder, not racial prejudice. This case was about someone who had money and celebrity and thought he didn't live by the rules that the rest of us do. And when I was done wrestling with myself, there was only one thing left to think about, one set of painful and conclusive images. Nicole Brown Simpson lying in a pool of 7/8 of her blood, her throat slit all the way to her spine, and Ronald Goldman, his hands diced by the knife that killed him, finished off with one last plunge of the blade into his chest. How could such intense rage be so methodical? I had been called to help those two people get some justice. Who was I to turn it down because I might be uncomfortable? So, in the end, there was only duty. Duty to the prosecutor's office, to the family of the victims, and even to the black community. Christopher Darden in contempt. That word again, black community. I would probably need him to break that down. I heard everything he said about being a black prosecutor. We've had black public defenders and black judges and all the rest. We need black prosecutors too. And, you know, that way we're participating in all aspects of the system and all the rest of it. But I don't know how participating in this case is serving the black community. I would need him to break that one down for me. Anywho, that is Christopher Darden. Number again is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you have thoughts on the first chunk of the audio, Christopher Darden's entry into the scenario, feel free to share *61. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, a line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Henry, in Chicago.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. Oh, this book, for me, this book is equivalent to what he criticized earlier in his work in regards to being a tabloid newspaper. This is, for me, what this book is. He criticized when he was talking about OJ's 52 witnesses on his list to visit him. Then he says that he had favorable treatment of law enforcement authorities. I mean, this guy's in jail. Black male privilege, I guess. he starts talking about the Resnick card and the race card. What is he talking about with that? I have no idea. He starts to talk about the Schiller book and how that is a character assassination against Nicole, but yet he is continually trying to character assassinate Johnny Cochran. Starts talking about his opening statements or assertions. You know, I am no legal expert, but I thought that opening statements were just opening statements. You know, you're just getting the tone ready for the case. I didn't think that you had to prove anything in an opening statement. You know, you prove everything in the trial. And then he says that, you know, I guess because of his, you know, Cochran's rhetoric, Nicole got what she deserved. And I never heard Johnny Cochran say anything of that nature. So his implying that, you know, what he's saying and Nicole got this guy's ridiculous. He's a racist, but he's ridiculous. And also, I wanted to comment on that snippet that you had on the Christopher Darden book when he talked about how OJ is an icon in the black community. Now, you know, I know you talk about, you know, black community as problematic, but, you know, when was icon attached to OJ and being in the black community? I mean, we all know him as a football player, but, you know, when somebody says something like that, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, maybe somebody like King or Malcolm or something like that. But, you know, I remember the first week we were on the book, you know, hardly anybody who was, you know, who was younger than, you know, 45 years old knew who he was. So what type of icon was he in the black community? You know, if he was an icon. So, but that's all I have on my line.
Questioning O.J. Simpson's icon status. Wow. I think retired firefighter in Florida, he can correct me if I'm wrong. I think he said, you know, O.J. Simpson, he won the Heisman and he was like the first black celebrity to have like mainstream appeal, meaning he was big spokesperson for Hertz and all these other advertisements and what have you. Like, hey, O.J. Simpson was on TV when you didn't even have lots of black people on TV back in the 80s and 90s. This is, you know, before Michael Jordan and everything. 70s and 80s, excuse me. Before Michael Jordan and, you know, all that, when you didn't see Kobe Bryant and such on TV every day. Like, he was, and he was in Roots, you know. He was, that's not doing it for you? That doesn't sound like icon in the black community?
Well, you know, and just using it as conjecture, when you talk about black community, I'm thinking about somebody who is doing something for the black community. I like I said, I know you, it's problematic, but I'm just using it as conjecture right now. So that's what I'm thinking about. I'm not thinking about somebody who is a celebrity, somebody who has done work in, you know, with black people, because the what you had just read in the Darden book in regards to why, you know, OJ was so highly held by, you know, black people. It's like, you know, I didn't understand what he was talking about. So it just led to a lot of confusion with me when that statement came up.
Hmm. Much obliged for the answer, Henry in Chicago. Wow. Compared Mr. Tubin's work to a tabloid rag. Oh, let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida.
I heard my identification. What was the questioning?
Well, your name was just mentioned around OJ being an icon. You talked before about him being a big celebrity and the first black person being a spokesperson for Hertz and some of these big companies. But I was just responding to Henry in Chicago talking about whether or not O.J. Simpson was an icon in the black community. That's from Christopher Darden's book. And he was questioning whether or not that is accurate. O.J. Simpson, an icon in the black community.
Yeah. Well, I am definitely not sure on what the term means exactly. I'm not saying I haven't heard of the word icon, but in the way it's used and what context, and I have come to understand based on logic that there's no such thing as a black community in itself. But I would say this about Orenthal James Simpson, as I think I've stated before. He had a favorable, best way I can describe this, he had a favorable presence. I put it, that's all I can think of right now as far as a second word to that. That actually lasted. See, most people didn't know about the part about him that Jim Brown understood, that Harry Edwards understood. Most black people didn't have that at all. And under a global system of racism, white supremacy, at that point in time in the 60s, when I was coming up as a child, TV became one of the main technical objects that can be in your home, probably the most prestigious, actually. It kind of like, you know, surpassed books very quickly. The TV did. And there was not a lot of black people that was coming on television at all, let alone talking about if they were coming on, it was some sort of Amos and Andy. They may have been showing some repeats on that back when I was coming up. The original was in the 50s, of course, but when I didn't have no memory of anything. But in the 60s, you know, maybe some Amos and Andy, Bill Cosby. But Bill Cosby, although he was an athlete, he wasn't to the magnitude of O.J. Simpson. And this started with him as an early 20-year-old at USC, is what I'm saying. I'm talking about even before he played professional football. He was a favorable non-white black male, not only to black males who was interested in sports. he was very favorable. I'm not saying everybody, but it was. I would say, in my opinion, it was high. And then when they started actually professionally marketing him, also, that was during his professional career. And especially because at first his career wasn't going too well, but it wasn't because of him. And as soon as the philosophy on their offensive team changed, that he became this quote unquote superstar with the sport, and in turn with the marketing, the constant you're seeing him on television, you know, every day. We're talking about in the 70s now. And in the 80s. So it was, you know, very favorable. Once again, I'm not saying that every black person loved him and liked him. And I would say a high percentage did not know the political Orenthal James Simpson that, let's say, Mr. Harry Edwards understood when he approached him about assisting them in the 1968 Olympic boycott, amongst some other things that he was going to do. going to do. And OJ stated back to him, I'm not black, I'm OJ, you know. And also Jim Brown knew him because, you know, he had conversations with him, but Jim Brown wasn't going to, quote unquote, expose him or anything like that. As far as that concerned, and that was not even that part of him was not known.
Hang on one
until
second. Retired Fry, we'll get to. I'm going to make sure we get to some of the other folks who dialed as well.
Yeah. I'm talking too much. Yeah, you're right. But anyway, that's basically that was.
Much obliged.
My thoughts. Thank you.
We will get you to get more of your commentary in before we sign out. Just making sure we get everybody commentary in as well.
Right on.
Let's see. I want to make sure I get in one of our investors who wrote in as well. Untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. We have folks, if you want to share and you're not able to call in, untiljustice@gmail.com. We'll read your commentary. Investor who wrote in, he said, greetings, Gus. Another superb interview with Pat McKenna. He was here. Was that yesterday? It was 2 days ago. Lost track of time. That was 2 days ago. Pat McKenna, who is the investigator. We heard about him last week in the book. White male. He was here. Lots of details on how he got the Mark Furman audio recordings and all the compared O.J. Simpson to George Floyd. Pat McKenna in the archives. I thought the most important thing he said, I'm paraphrasing, was that to convict an innocent man, everybody has to be on the same page. The police, the lawyers, the judges, and the crime scene investigators. That is something that he said. We all have to be on the same page. Chapter 13, Blaming Faye. Number one, Christopher Darden. It has certainly been on the minds of people up in Richmond, California. The case needed a black prosecutor. In retrospect, this seems like obvious pandering directed at the black jurors. I suspect the jurors felt the same way, and it may have made them less sympathetic to the prosecution at the very start of the trial. Number two, Darden's opening statement, characterized by Tubin, a great edifice of rhetoric built on a foundation of little evidence. The prosecution's problem was exacerbated, of course, by the makeup of the jury, which was filled with people predisposed to admire Simpson and to discount evidence of domestic violence. Seems like Tubin is admitting that the prosecution doesn't have much of a case. I'm confused. Me too. I was thinking the same thing. Moreover, on what basis does he make the claim that black women discount domestic violence? Question. Number three, Decision Quest Company's pro bono assistance in making charts and other visual aids for the prosecution cost paying clients nearly $1 million. FBI, Secret Service, multiple local police jurisdictions, Interpol, and $1 million for free visual aids. Racist man and racist woman can sure bring a lot of resources when they want to get their Negro. Absolutely. And Johnny Cochran, I read that section from his book before where he talked about how they had to pay quite a lot of money to get assistance from Joanne Dimitri. She helped them with jury consultancy, that they had to pay her a lot of money. And for a lot of the other resources that they got, O.J. Simpson had to pay a lot of money, and he doesn't have anywhere near the amount of resources as the district attorney's office for the city of Los Angeles. Like, I won't say endless resources, but a lot more than one individual black male. Let's see. Number four, Goldman brings the glasses to Nicole's house, 9:50. The dog barked at 10:15 p.m. Limousine driver saw him, O.J., at 10:55. The timeline. I will always remember what McKenna said. He just didn't have enough time. That, in my opinion, that is the most important piece. And you heard some of it already from Tubin when he was talking about that 10:15. Why are we tied to 10:15? Why are we tied to 10:15? Particularly when you have many, many, many other witnesses and corroborating evidence that suggests, man, maybe this happened later.
Maybe this happened substantially later than 10:15, 15, 20 minutes later than 10:15. In which case, now we're really talking. Do we really think O.J. Simpson had time to do all this and get back home? If this happened at 10:30, 10:35, somewhere in there, do we really think he had that much time to do this and be back home ready to roll in 20 minutes? Is that what we're saying? Continuing. Number five, Schiller's plan worked. The book called I Want to Tell You, it wasn't just O.J.'s obvious guilt that Schiller found amusing. He also scoffed at the notion that Simpson actually wrote or said all that was attributed to him in the book. The opinions of another seedy character. Indeed, and there are many of them connected to the O.J. Simpson case. O.J. Simpson, I believe, has said repeatedly over the years that he just looks everybody who comes to be in contact with them. He's already thinking, how can they make some money off of the juice? How can they make some money off of me? And probably in the process, suggest and continue to prove that I am guilty of murder. We'll pause there because he goes to the next chapter. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Hey, what's going on, Gus? How you doing? Caller from New Jersey.
Greetings.
All right. How you doing this evening?
Poorly, right? Poorly.
All right. Gus, this whole book is very entertaining and informative. And like the guests that you had on this week, I mean, this OJ trial encompasses everything. The lying white woman. Emma Till, the police brutality, gaslighting Black America. I mean, this trial just encompasses every area of people activity, and also as it relates to racism, white supremacy. I must say, I can go on record, even with the limited knowledge that I had concerning this case. I learned a lot following the book. I always thought OJ was innocent. When I asked the guest about the Goldman family, I just really never understood, you're innocent to proven guilty. And even in grief, you know, not knowing all the facts, you know, how the family just indicted OJ, and it just kind of like went from grief to just a money grab to just trying to destroy this man. And I didn't have knowledge about the timeline, but as I do remember, I remember that piece about the timeline, and that always stuck with me, you know. So again, I'm still learning, but if anybody, like you said, and I do agree, if anybody want a case study of racism, white supremacy, it's the OJ trial. I mean, you have everything from police brutality to the lying white woman to just basically the danger of white friends, how all OJ's so-called white allies, white friends turned on him. Wow. wow. That's all I can say.
Much obliged, caller in New Jersey. Absolutely right. Again, Pat McKenna, he was just with us 2 days ago, investigator for Mr. Simpson. And I've said this is a great case study if you want to study the system of white supremacy, racism, and as he said, all areas of people activity, all racial showcasing, lots of reasons in terms of why sexual intercourse with white people is probably not a good idea, like all kinds. Oh, and the importance of words, particularly as the trial progresses, the importance of words. Oh, masterclass from Mr. Johnny Cochran. Let's see. I'll share through a few of my notes. We'll nab some of the other folks who dialed in. Let's see. Some of the notes that I took. Now, we heard from Christopher Darden. He said, hey, this is not a case about race. It's about evidence. They didn't pick me because I'm a black guy. They picked me because I had done great work. He was already working on the A.C. Cowlings case. So he was familiar with the evidence and what have you. Wouldn't be someone you'd have to catch up to speed, as they say. So why did they need a black prosecutor? Tubin says, hey, they got Johnny Cochran and Carl Douglas. And I guess Sean Chapman, too. She's a black female who worked with the Cochran firm. So they have three black lawyers who are directly there sitting with O.J. Simpson. And O.J. Simpson is black. And you got a non-white judge. So is it that we think, since we've got, at the time, I believe, well, I just eventually it's going to end up being nine black jurors. It might not have been that exact composition originally, even though it was high, but eventually it's going to end up being nine black jurors. So we need to have at least one black person make it seem like this is not just all white people prosecuting black people, even though that is a big chunk of the history of white supremacy right on up to 2021, a room full of white people prosecuting, accusing, blaming a black person for all kinds of things. That happens every day and it's no problem. I don't know why all of a sudden in this case, oh yeah, we might need to steal at least one. Hey, Christopher Darden, come here and be on this case. We need you to get the juice here. Yes. And Mac, matter of fact, you start things off and talk about how your people want to make sure that justice is done in the Simpson case. Does not get any better than tacky. Let's see. Next. I so appreciated frickin' Jeff Tubin and all these folks. O.J. Simpson is a batterer. He's a beater. He beat Nicole Brown Simpson. And let's hear that 1993 audio call. One incident of physical abuse. All the rest of it we got, he called her fat in public. That, I am appalled. That's what we're sitting here listening to. He called her fat in public. He took away her independence by getting her a Porsche. Are you flipping? The sentence that I told you all last week from F. Lee Bailey, he was explaining their indignation with these charges. Like, I cannot even believe that they have had the audacity to come out and charge our client with this nonsense. Like, just listen to this. Like, this is the, and I mean, you can hear, you can go online. All this, the opening arguments, everything is on YouTube. So you can go and listen to all of this. But I mean, are you serious? This is the so-called evidence that you all are coming out to charge OJ. Like, I could see you all could get away with this. This is just some homeless black person, Freddie Gray or whatever. Yeah. Okay. You could do that. But OJ Simpson, you could come out with this nonsense and say that he committed this double murder. And this is the evidence you got. Like, come on, come on. Let's see. The next one, yet at the time of greatest fear, with her life literally on the line, she apparently felt unable to turn to the police, her friends, or even to her family. She had nowhere to go except a public battered woman's shelter. Oh, whoa, last week. Make sure I get back to this week's notes. He calls Christopher Darden. He says he slips into a kind of California psychobabble at times. I don't even know what that is, but I mean, that's what we're leading with. California psychobabble to charge O.J. Simpson. And saying that he stripped her of her self-esteem. He was so controlling that he attempted to define her identity, define who she was by getting her a Porsche and paying for her family's bills, having her whole family on OJ welfare. Tell me something, man. Tell me something. It wasn't even Nicole Simpson. It was Nicole Brown Simpson. Come on, man. Come on. Let's see. He says next. Everyone in the Brown family except OJ arrived late at the recital bearing flowers for Sydney, Darden said, and he greeted everyone in the Brown family except Nicole. Simpson moved to a chair to the corner of the auditorium and he sat there facing Nicole and he just stared at her. He just stared. sat there staring at her. This was a menacing stare, a penetrating stare. It was an angry stare. The scowling Negro. They got reckless eyeballing. You got a whole lot of black people who have been lynched. Reckless eyeballing, they call it. It made everyone uncomfortable. Presumably, this is going to come up in the trial. I'm just mentioning because he's talking about it, and it's so ludicrous. They have video of the recital. He's right there talking to these people, some of the very white people who got on the stand. Oh, he was a frightening brute. Oh, he beat Nicole. Oh, is that you in the video right there kissing O.J. Simpson? Is that you in the video right there hugging O.J. Simpson at the recital literally hours before the murder? Does he look menacing? Is he frightening? And we're like, come on, come on. Let's see. And as the Brown family left, they looked toward the defendant and they saw him, and he was angry. The black male. He was depressed and they were concerned, and everybody wondered, what is he up to now? Again, they got video. I don't know if they were aware that there was video of this recital and what people looked like afterwards. But man, when that... Presumably that will come up in the trial shortly, because that came up when the prosecution was parading their character witnesses out very early. Let's see. But even though Clark had dismissed Decision Quest from the jury, oh, this is how they got all this $1 million worth of free visuals. Again, normally if it's Olden Sampson and you don't have any resources, there is no way you're going to stack up against all of this. You could be totally innocent. Barry Scheck, the Innocent Project. We talked about lots of these folks. Curtis Flowers. They just make up things. Oh, you did it. You did it. Oh, yeah, he did it. We got a glove and we got a spot of blood and we got something that we made up or whatever. We got a lying white woman or a lying white man or whatever the case may be. We got a Mark Furman or three in the police department who finagled some evidence. What are you going to do? You're not going to have Barry Scheck. You're not going to have Robert Shapiro. You're not going to have Johnny Cochran. You're not going to have Benjamin Crump even, probably. Let's cop a deal. Let's see. Clark's, oh, the timeline. I love, now, he says Clark's, Marsha Clark's precision extended even to the animal world, that is, to the subject of barking dogs. At approximately 10:15 p.m., she said Pablo Fenvet. I don't know how much will be included in the book about Pablo Fenves, but we put an asterisk right there. Pablo Fenves, who lived diagonally across the alley behind Nicole's condominium, heard a dog begin to bark. A moment later, Clark even repeated the time, this time without qualifying approximately. The dog barked at 10:15. Clark thus committed the prosecution to a theory of the case that had the murders taking place shortly before 10:15. As Clark knew, even before her opening statement, other credible evidence put the time of the murders about 15 minutes later, maybe even 20 later, placing the murders at 10:30 or even shortly after, or better yet, leaving the time somewhat vague at that early stage in the case. Could still have served the prosecution's purposes. Not really, but again, Clark's arrogance led her to an unwise commitment. Now, again, he set up at the beginning of the book, Marsha Clark, white woman, was arrogant. That was a part of their demise. Christopher Darden was incompetent. He doesn't classify Marsha Clark as lying. He doesn't classify Marsha Clark as even being incompetent right here for putting this time together, because I'm going to have to really pay attention. I was reading Donald Freed's book, Killing Time, and, you know, several of these books on the case. And then we talked to Pat McKenna the other day. I'm going to have to pay attention as we go through to really look at this. But unless I'm in error, every witness who lived at the Bundy location, Nicole Brown Simpson's residence where the murders took place, every ear witness, every eyewitness testifies to these murders happening after 10:20, after 10:30, except Pablo Fenves. And the only witness, I'm going to have to make sure I double check to make sure I'm not being false here, but if that's true, like, woo, that is something alone to stand out. Unless I'm in error, Pablo Fendez is the only ear witness that the prosecution uses. The defense took all the other ear witnesses at the Bundy location, which is absurd because I believe, unless I'm in error, we're, you know, going to go through all this. So I'm going to pay attention as we go through. Man, all of the ear witnesses thought OJ was guilty, even though they didn't see him. They didn't have anything incriminating. They were just like everybody else. Me too. He did it. But their testimony would tend to exonerate him. That was why the defense scooped them all. But I think, unless I'm wrong, Pablo Fendez is the only ear witness, eyewitness at the Bundy location that the prosecution took. And he's saying 10-15. And I'm saying no. Everybody else is saying no. Happened substantially later. 15, 20 minutes later, in fact. We will pay attention as we go. Let's see. Okay, and now he switches to some of the witnesses that they call. Marsha Clark mentioning Kelvin Cato, which is stunning, particularly in the scheme of things. You have to wait till we get to when he gets called. But wow, that's one of the only witnesses that you mentioned by name is Cato. Amazing. And then she comes back. Never in her opening did Clark mention the name of the detective who found the glove, Mark Furman. Spectacular point that Johnny Cochran hammers over and over. I had an audio segment to include of that from the opening statements where Johnny Cochran beautifully makes that point. Like, wow, this is their star witness. He found the glove and he hopped the fence. And you don't mention him at all. Why are they hiding Mark? If you're in the jury box and you wrote that down that day, why didn't they mention Mark? Johnny L. Cochran Jr., the grandcestor. Let's see. Next. He goes to the treatment, how Johnny Cochran treated the witnesses. He says this case is a rusted judgment. That is one of the refrains from Johnny Cochran and the defense in general. Rush to judgment. Cochran asserted an obsession to win at any cost and by any means necessary, invoking Malcolm X's most famous phrase. Now, Malcolm X does use that phrase, but I hear many other people use the phrasing by any means necessary. And they are not referencing Malcolm X. I've heard a number of folks. He absolutely could have been invoking that here, but it's not being applied to black people. It's being applied to the Mark Furmans of the world. So, let's see. The bringing up of the sexual exploits, I think it's extremely important because if we're saying they just want to say, oh, he's smearing this white woman, talking about all of her sexual conduct. Number one, you already had Faye Resnick, who wrote this trashy book, doing all of the same. So whatever. And is it true? But the main thing, bringing this up, if you're going to say that O.J. Simpson, he took her youth, he took her self-respect, he was controlling, violent, a brute savage. If you're going to say all that, well, then wait a minute. If she is out and engaged in sexual activity and lesbian sexual activity and hooking up with all these other guys and everything, why didn't he go crazy and kill her then and kill some of these other guys then or kill Faye Resnick then? Logic, in my opinion. And in my view, in the system of white supremacy, there generally is a great deal of time and energy invested in protecting the innocence of white women, protecting their innocence as practicing white supremacists, leaving out, hey, we had a white woman, Carolyn Bryant, her participation in the lynching of Emmett Till, lying, and then perhaps her even being present at the location of the murder. And covering up for white women, their sexual exploits, we want to maintain them as pure. We don't want you to think of them as Kim Kardashian out sex taping, you know, Negroes and everything. No, clean that up. They're virtuous. Yes. Chastity belt. Yes. Yes. Get out of here. Let's see. He says, Cochran then said Faye Resnick was one of the people that called Mr. Cole Brown Simpson on the night of June 12, confirmed, perhaps after 9 o'clock, that particular night from this drug treatment facility, confirmed. After a pause, Cochran said darkly, "We will be talking about that and her role in this whole drama." Let's see whatever darkly means. He mentions the role of Lawrence Schiller and his involvement in the production Springtime for Hitler, this controversial Hitler has a revival and does a sitcom and all of this. Always find some way of invoking Adolf Hitler in popular culture, movies, films, all the rest of it. Let's see. Matthew Broderick, I think they did a big hit of the producers where this number is there, Springtime for Hitler. Let's see. He leaves out some of the anecdotes from the book. I want to tell you from O.J. Simpson, many of the racist letters that people wrote in calling him a coon and a rapist and all the rest of it. I hope you die. All of that. I have some of the excerpts from that if you want to hear a few of those. Let's see. Then he says the point was to muddy the character of the target of this homicide. In the end, the reason for the defense's obsession with Resnick can be found in the focus groups, that is, in the overwhelming lack of sympathy that black women felt for Nicole Brown Simpson. The Resnick card was just another version of the race card in this case, an outlet for the resentment of black women toward the blonde temptress who snared this black hero. What in the world? I am stunned. Now, point blank, I think we talked before about Gold Digger and all that, and folks said, I think it's accurate. He's setting up her whole family, blah, blah, blah. Jeffrey Toobin, I even want to pause for a second for him to talk all this about, Johnny Cochran and his character assassination of the victims and portraying Nicole as some low-count white woman with no more. He described her as a party animal before. Like, let's put facts out of it. It's true. Like, we're not going to sit around and, oh, she was a great person, a great job, and a great mother. If she was freebasing and hanging out with drug addicts and doing all this, then that's what it is. No ambition. Remember what? She didn't even want a job. Just, I'm going to lounge around and play with my Porsche, my Ferrari, whatever ride OJ hooked me up with. Get out of here. Let's see. Cochran's star witness, Mary Ann Gerches, turned out to be a pathological liar who spent her life dodging creditors and who, shortly after Cochran's opening statement, would plead guilty to defrauding the Marriott Hotel of more than $24,000. Before Gerches pleaded guilty, she claimed that an imposter using her name had actually run up the bill at the hotel. The defense would never call Gerches either. They did call Lopez. That is important. I'm sure that comes up in the trial later. But the problem I have with this is accurate. Mary Ann Gerches, she did plead guilty, charged for fraud, $24,000 bill and all that. Absolutely. There were lots, and I mean lots, of white people who got involved in this case and non-white people. Let me see if I can get some money, some exposure, the tabloids. Like, there was tons of that for both sides, prosecution and defense. The major problem I have with this is that Jill Shively is the exact same thing. And if you're going to present Jill Shively as though she is a credible witness, even though Marcia Clark and Marcia Clark's book was published before this book, Marcia Clark includes in her book, Jill Shively is a liar. That's why I didn't present her testimony. Not that we're sanctimonious and egalitarian prosecutors and we don't want to use people who sold their testimony to the tabloids for money. That's not why we didn't include Jill Shively. She's a liar, a pathological liar, in fact, just like what he's asserting about Mary Ann Gerches. So if you're not going to do that equally and say that, hey, there were people like this for both sides, it's just going to be lopsided. The defense had these questionable witnesses and the prosecution had witnesses like Jill Shively, who could have tipped the scale but didn't testify. And he even said that about Faye Resnick. She could have testified and tipped the scale. Really? This coked out white chick? Really? All right, Jeff Toobin, let's see. And same thing Henry in Chicago said. Johnny Cochran at no point said Nicole Brown Simpson got what she deserved. No one for the defense. O.J. Simpson said Nicole Brown Simpson got what she deserved. It was said, hey, there was a lot of drug activity happening here. Wow, who knows what could have happened? The main point being O.J. Simpson didn't do this, but there is a lot of crazy behavior. Now, when I say crazy, drug activity, people who are involved in drugs, what's going on here? Let's do a full investigation. Nobody said Nicole Brown Simpson got what she deserved. Let's see. I think those are all the notes that I got for chapter 14. Let's see. Caller at 2824. Did you have commentary? Caller at two, last four digits, 2824. Did you have commentary? Just listening. We'll assume you're just listening.
Hello?
Hello? Went too quick. Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Hey, yo, this is B from Santa Rosa. I always thought OJ was innocent, but it was this one point in my life where I thought he was guilty because everybody else was saying it's crazy. He just all of a sudden popped up in my head. He's probably guilty. Yeah, he probably is. But my whole life, I was like, nah, man, I don't think he did it. It just didn't add up to me. I was born in San Francisco, went to Petrel Hills, the same middle school he went to. And then I moved to Richmond, graduated from Richmond High. So I'm like, oh my God, Petrel Hills, San Francisco, Richmond, OJ. But there's a couple of things that stood out to me. Earlier in the book, the author, he said, domestic violence linchpin. I don't know what that means. Like, couldn't figure out what that meant. And he also said, do you know O.J. Simpson? And I'm thinking, shit, do you know Nicole Brown? Because she seemed wild to me. And, the dog, the barking dog, when she mentioned the dog confirmed the time, I'm thinking to myself, like, oh, who is she? Is she that little boy from Lassie? Like, she can talk to the dog? Is there something going on? What time did it happen? Like, she was going to get something out of that, but I don't think so. And, that's pretty much about it, what I got from it. One thing that had me cracking up. It was from the last segment, the Brentwood hello. That had me on my back. Like, I couldn't believe that. From now on, me and my friends, we say the Brentwood hello from now on. That's all I have.
Wow. Get a caller from O.J. Simpson's childhood stomping ground right there in San Francisco. He played for the 49ers and everything. And that's why I said I think this is such a great case to make a case study. Like, I talked to some Cal's listeners, like, hey, if you have a counter-racist library, you can have, you know, your O.J. Simpson library. Have a few books, maybe get F. Lee Bailey's book when it comes out. And several other folks have wrote, I don't know if you need to have Tubin's book, but, you know, whatever. You could have your Johnny Cochran's book. You could have your O.J. Simpson library, because that's what I said for myself. Like, I didn't watch the trial. I didn't have any details or evidence, but just the racist osmosis of everybody saying he's guilty. Jeffrey Toobin and everybody, he's guilty. He did it. And then the FX series and ESPN and blah, 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 and all the rest of it. Just, oh, yeah, he probably did it. Yeah, yeah. It's osmosis. It would just seep in. Yeah. Unless you have some details and evidence, you have some information. Like, oh, yeah, this is total white supremacy propaganda. Like, get out of here, Jeff Toobin. Let's see. Person 9029.
Oh, greetings, Gus, and greetings, callers and listeners. Chris Darden's part was really tough to listen to. As you were reading that over, he sounded so confused and unsure of what direction he wanted to go, and it resonated throughout that writing. I mean, anyone that read it that has any kind of counter-racist code could see that he was a confused non-white male, and they basically baited him and they played on that like they often do in most situations. It's unfortunate that you know, I mean, I, you know, a lot of respect to his father, I think it was, who told him not even to get involved. But, you know, it was just a situation where he got used again, just like most non-white people do. The defense, I didn't understand Toobin's point where he was saying no, at no point did the defense bring other points to the case to point to somebody else or some other murderers or killers. That's not the defense's job. The defense's job is to make sure that they prove that their client is not guilty beyond a shadow of a doubt. The police department and law enforcement's job is to go after the actual killers, not them. So I was kind of confused how he's even intertwining that and writing it into the story. And I the FX series, I finally finished that. And I'm actually surprised that there's no lawsuit for that. Like OJ can't sue FX or Jeffrey Toobin for the like defamation of character or anything. There's nothing written or said that he can write this type of work, and then they based the movie off of it, a miniseries off of it. And when I watched it, it was clear at every turn where there was a point where they could make it seem like he was guilty or point to some evidence that he was. Even the briefcase is in the movie, by the way, that I believe that Robert Shapiro, I think, took, if I'm correct. I'm not sure. But even that's in the movie. And then they make it seem like it mysteriously disappears, and that's the briefcase that has everything. And it's, you know, it's really telltale sign, and it is a study case. But also I wanted to ask you, how is the book Killing Time so far? I was thinking about purchasing it, and because that's what I'd prefer to purchase first before anything else, to be honest. And I'll mute my line.
Much obliged. It does have constructive information in terms of the witnesses, like he does with the timeline. He spends a good chunk of the first portion of the book just discussing the timeline and the prosecute. The same thing that I just said, the same thing that I think a lot of folks who just looked at the timeline component of this, like, man, this is not logically, this is not adding up, like what they're saying and looking at the collection of witnesses. And that does have some of the tabloidy stuff in there too, which, you know, some people are interested in, like, hey, let's hear some more of that. Like when I say tabloidy stuff, like more of the drug stuff, the Faye Resnick stuff, which, you know, that did come out in the trial, that is pertinent. But yeah, it does have constructive information. I don't know if it's one of the top books I've read on the Simpson case. I'm still reading material, but it does have constructive information. Just I was a little disappointed that it did have a little more tabloidy type stuff in it. But yes, it does have constructive info. Get a used copy, I'd say that. I wish.
Question in the FX.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, in the FX movie, I noticed that they didn't have all the people on the stand. I think there were some people. One of the, I forgot the gentleman that came and you interviewed them about, I think, last week. He stated that there were some people that didn't even get in the movie or in any books because they were in the witness protection program and they were in organized crime.
Oh, the Fiano
they never
brothers.
Even. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Like, that's what I'm kind of curious about. Like, how is that networked into this whole situation? So.
I think
a lot of details, a lot of things missing, a lot of people don't know about.
Absolutely. The Fiato brothers, they are included in Donald Freed's book, Killing Time. He gets into that. That's more of the drug related bits of the case and what have you. More of that information is in Donald Freed's book, Killing Time. The FX, I can only say the FX. And even for this book, we're halfway through the book, a little over halfway through the book. In my opinion, that lets me know there's a lot of information that is not going to be included in what took place in the trial, because the first half of this book basically goes from June, the night of the murders, June 12, 1994, to the beginning of the trial, January 1995. So that's basically 6 months. The trial lasted 10 months and had substantially more information, like very comprehensive and, you know, what question. I mean, sometimes you want to go right to the transcript, question, answer, like, and that went on for hours, for days and days and days. So, I mean, I don't think everything is included in the book. Clearly with TV, that is never the case. So, I mean, my goodness, they, it's 10 episodes. Yeah. It's extremely abbreviated. You always expect that for a TV series. And that's just white supremacy propaganda. Like if you watch the FX series, without any information, you will for sure just OJ Simpson is for sure guilty. Let me, in fact, give one more little nugget. We'll get to our second audio, but let me give one more bit from Christopher Darden in Contempt. Reading more important than watching television. So he says, all of a sudden, he shows up here, Cochran said of me. Now, why is that? After we have 8 African Americans on the jury, we're concerned about it. Why now? I watched in disbelief. This was a man I considered a colleague. We had worked separately on many of the same cases. Him from the civil side, me from the criminal. Battles against racist cops and unnecessary police violence. Now he was accusing me of being a sellout. Didn't say sellout. I understand that he had a job to do to protect his client, but this had nothing to do with that. This was a private message between Cochran and me, a message meant to be overheard by anyone who had ever been pulled over by a police officer because he looked suspicious in his dark skin. Blacks could hear what he was saying between the lines. This brother is being used by the man. This brother is an Uncle Tom. It was the most offensive thing a black could be called by another black, and hearing it repeated on television and in the newspapers was the equivalent of publicly being called a nigger by a white lawyer. What a metaphor. Under the guise of looking at AC Cowlings, either all along he was planning on working on the OJ Simpson case, we don't think that's fair, or he's over here because of the makeup of our jury, which I think is wrong, Cochran said. Christopher Darden is a fine lawyer, but I don't think he should be on this case. There have been many long nights after that one. There have been death threats and racist letters from whites and blacks. Racist letters from black people? There have been nights when I couldn't believe the pain this case was causing my family. Yet, I will never forget how I felt that first night, watching Johnny Cochran make it painfully clear that there were going to be two sides in this case, not prosecution and defense, but black and white, and I was welcome on neither. I will never forget watching Cochran draw a line in the sand. I will never forget watching him choose that butcher over me. Black professionals always have to justify their existence. We go to work and face stares that insinuate we have only achieved because of quotas and affirmative action, not because of ability. We are always having to justify our presence in the boardroom, the operating room, and unfortunately the courtroom. But I didn't expect it from another black lawyer. I didn't expect it from Cochran. The fallout was immediate. On talk radio and in newspapers, in barbershops and restaurants, I was branded an Uncle Tom, a sellout, a house Negro. I couldn't understand how they could attack me when they didn't know me. Other black experts stepped forward, such as a lawyer named Leo Terrell, who was suddenly on every television show that would have him, saying that I had a responsibility to the community, there's that word again, and to my blackness to reject the case. I waited for the prominent blacks to come to my defense to say that Cochran was wrong, to question my ethics and my reasons for being on the case. I waited for prominent blacks to say that they were proud and that we had black prosecutors as well as black defense attorneys, that it was bigoted and small-minded to expect only one philosophy and one position from African Americans. I waited, but they were silent. All I heard was Cochran's message to me echoing in the deafening lack of support. Dear Chris, the message said, we are playing for keeps. The next day, I went to Gil Garcetti and his director of communications, Suzanne Childs, to talk about my addition to the case. Actually, I'll stop there. The only thing, he asks permission to do some interviews with black newspapers like the LA Sentinel and what have you, so that he can kind of give his side of the story and ask them to stop calling him an Uncle Tom. I'm sorry for laughing. It's not funny. He's a victim of white supremacy. If I had been in Christopher Darden's position, like, whew, I'm sure I would not find it funny. All of that said, he goes to ask Gil Garcetti, white man district attorney, if he could talk to the black press. And of course, they say no. The mandate is no press. They do have a couple moments where they give brief question answers, like immediately as they leave the courtroom a few times, but they're not, no one from the prosecution except Gil Garcetti is doing like Larry King or, you know, black, the LA Sentinel, nothing like that is happening while the trial is ongoing except for Gil Garcetti. So Christopher Darden just has to take all these insults for, can you imagine being on 150 million people tuned in live to watch the verdict of this trial? Can you imagine being branded an Uncle Tom in a sellout for 10 months in front of the whole world? I should stop. It's not funny. It's totally not funny. If I was Chris Darden, I would not find it funny at all. Like, and his family, like, victim of, that's why I say there's only one word, victim of white supremacy, even though absolutely white people used, manipulated. Yes, we need a black person. Let's see if this will help us to nab O.J. Simpson. We will get to the second audio segment. I know we missed a few folks. You know, we'll nab you. Second audio segment is shorter, so we'll have time to chat. The peep or the run of his life, the people, the O.J. Simpson, Jeffrey Toobin, Zoom bomber of 2020, context of white supremacy. This is audio segment number two.
Chapter 14. Thank you, Carl. Ito broke for the day early on January 25th so that the prosecutors could regroup and decide what sanctions they would ask the judge to impose on the defense for its discovery violations. Hodgman trudged upstairs with his colleagues to weigh what they should do. For Bill Hodgman, assignment to the Simpson case had paid few dividends. He did not escape all of his administrative responsibilities, yet he didn't have full control of the trial either. Though Clark had recently served as Hodgman's assistant in the office, and though the two of them were nominally identified as co-lead counsel, the case remained fundamentally hers. Their temperaments were ill-matched. Clark, mercurial, passionate, disorganized. Hodgman, methodical, contemplative, a little dull. He scheduled meetings at 3:30, and Clark appeared at 5. It wasn't that Clark was slacking off. She probably worked more total hours than her colleague. But she did it in an anarchic manner that drove Hodgman to distraction. Hodgman felt betrayed, too, by the discovery violations and other ethical lapses of Cochran and his colleagues. In all, the pressure was great, the rewards few. As Hodgman and Clark were briefing Gil Garcetti on the day's events, Hodgman noticed a strange feeling in his chest. Not pain exactly, but a tightening. He got up and walked around, but the sensation didn't go away. At Garcetti's suggestion, paramedics were called, and about 6:20 p.m., an ambulance took Hodgman to the California Medical Center. He was, at the time, 41 years old. Doctors found an irregular pattern in his electrocardiogram and decided to keep him overnight. A senior member of Garcetti's staff called Ito at home to give him the news, and by morning word of Hodgman's hospitalization had leaked out to the news media. The hospital was promptly besieged by television satellite trucks, and white-jacketed doctors began conducting briefings in a manner usually associated with presidential illnesses. In the end, Hodgman was fine. His condition was temporary, seemingly the result of stress and overwork. Though he returned to the DA's office after only a few days at home, and he continued to supervise the case, Hodgman had to yield his courtroom role. Henceforth, the case would be tried by Marcia Clark and Chris Darden. Hodgman's departure would turn out to be one of the most important events of the trial. His absence deprived the prosecution of a day-to-day center of gravity, a voice of calm and maturity. Hodgman could tell the difference between an everyday dispute and a bona fide crisis. Clark and Darden, in contrast, tried cases in an atmosphere of perpetual turmoil, much of it self-generated. The shift in mood was immediately apparent. Addressing Judge Ito about the discovery violations, Clark and Darden nearly became unhinged. True, the defense had engaged in rather cynical misconduct, but in the context of a long trial, the withholding of a few witnesses' statements was probably not going to amount to much. What should have mattered more to the prosecution was simply getting the case underway and its witnesses on the stand. Instead, for several hours, Clark and Darden ranted. Clark: "Unfortunately, because of the nature of this misconduct, which is egregious and flagrant and not the minor violation that Cochran attempts to represent to this court, he's attempting to sweep it under the rug, claim ignorance, and use Mr. Douglas as a sacrificial lamb. And that is absolutely inappropriate. Counsel should bear the brunt of his own misconduct, which is willful and deliberate and intentional, and is in fact a thumbing of his nose at this court's order." And so on. Darden's behavior was even stranger. Cochran's stature in L.A.'s black legal community was such that the relatively inexperienced Darden was, perhaps understandably, intimidated by his mere presence. And the older man would use this against the younger man time and again during the course of the trial. Cochran's hold over Darden bordered on the mystical, and more precisely, the parental. This often led the prosecutor to behave like an adolescent, appearing alternately to disdain and beseech his elder. When Cochran spoke in court, Darden would often hunch over in his seat, hold his head in his hands, puff his cheeks, and pout theatrically. On this day, and several others during the trial, Darden seemed to blurt out the first thing that came into his head. "Had we known about some of these witnesses," Darden said to Ito, and quite obviously the television camera, "we could have informed counsel that they are heroin addicts, thieves, felons, and that one of these witnesses, one of their so-called material witnesses, is the only person I have ever known to be a court-certified pathological liar." This was a scandalous remark to make about a dozen people who had done no more than have their names mentioned by a lawyer in a criminal trial. To be sure, some of them, like Gertz's, were questionable characters, but others were upstanding, ordinary citizens who had cooperated with both sides and simply remembered events in a manner helpful to the defendant's case. Darden's group libel reflected his own immaturity more than the witnesses' true natures. Rambling on, Darden turned to the subject of Cochran. "You know, as I sat there yesterday, watching Mr. Cochran, I noticed that his opening statement, most of it was typed. He had time to type it, to type out that opening statement. And it was a very fine opening statement. And I'm always proud of Mr. Cochran when I see him in court, Your Honor. I love him. I just don't like to go up against him. But if he had time to type his opening statement, then he had time to turn it over. And I'm disappointed in Mr. Cochran." So it went, for hour after hour. Darden at one point requested that the trial be delayed for 30 days as a result of the defense misconduct, a patently absurd idea when a sequestered jury was waiting to hear testimony. Ito, characteristically, said nothing during the lengthy harangues by the lawyers, not even when Darden made his bizarre profession of love for Cochran. After only about 15 minutes, the lawyers started repeating themselves, concentrating mainly on cranking up the invective. Ito froze. A stronger, more self-confident judge would have stopped the name-calling, limited debate, and focused on the jury, which had been sitting in a hotel room for 2 full weeks and had not even heard all of the opening statements. In the end, Ito reached a reasonable resolution of the issue. He agreed to put off the conclusion of Cochran's opening statement until Monday, January 30th, to advise the jury that defense misconduct had caused the delay, and to allow Clark to make a brief reopening statement the following day. It was 10:05 a.m. on January 31st when Lance Ito asked, "Mr. Darden, who is your first witness?" During jury selection in the fall, Ito had told the panel that he expected the entire trial would be over by late February. Prosecutors know they have a jury's full attention at the beginning of a trial, so they like to start out with a dramatic, powerful witness who cannot be effectively cross-examined. Darden and Clark chose well. Sharon Gilbert, Your Honor. Gilbert, a rotund and good-natured black woman, was working as a 911 operator in downtown Los Angeles during the early morning hours of January 1st, 1989. Her phone rang at 3:58 a.m. This was not Nicole's famous 911 call from 1993. This was, in its way, far more chilling. When Darden played the tape of this call, there were no words, just a rumbly silence, as if a phone had been left hanging limp from a table. Then a woman screamed, and screamed some more. Next, unmistakably, flesh collided with flesh, the sound of slapping or hitting of some kind. After about 3 minutes, the line went dead. Gilbert's computer had registered that the call came from 360 North Rockingham, so she urgently dispatched a police unit to the location. The assignment went to Officer John Edwards, who was working in a patrol car with a trainee, Patricia Maluski. Darden called Edwards as his next witness. Edwards told of finding Nicole, her face battered, staggering around the bushes in just sweatpants and a bra. He recalled her prophetic cries of, "He's going to kill me! He's going to kill me!" Cochran's cross-examination was more notable for what he didn't do than what he did. The lawyer poked a little fun at the detective, noting that he had languished as a patrol officer for 19 long years. Continuing his effort to diminish Nicole in the eyes of the jury, Cochran also asked a whole series of questions that suggested, without any evidence, that Nicole had been drunk during the New Year's Day altercation. But Cochran had a grenade in his pocket that he declined to use. Cochran never pointed out for the jury that in 1991, John Edwards had been named one of only 44 officers identified by the Christopher Commission as part of a problem group within the LAPD. The commission, formed to investigate the police in light of the Rodney King beating, found that these officers had received highly disproportionate numbers of complaints for use of excessive force, dishonesty, discourtesy, and other misdeeds. In the Los Angeles black community, following the release of the Christopher Commission's report, the existence of the 44 became important symbols of the LAPD's malevolence. Yet Cochran passed on the chance to tie Edwards in to his favorite theme of police racism. The reason for this uncharacteristic diffidence became apparent as Edwards was followed to the stand by other officers involved in the 1989 incident. What was remarkable about their testimony was not how hard they had been on O.J. Simpson, but how easy. Faced with a badly beaten woman who had the red imprint of a human hand on her neck, Edwards did not arrest the man who admitted to causing her injuries, not even after learning from both O.J. and Nicole that police had been called out to the house repeatedly on domestic violence calls. Rather, even after O.J. conceded that he had hurt Nicole, and even after Nicole told him that O.J. kept guns in the house, Edwards graciously allowed Simpson to return to his house by himself and change out of his bathrobe, And then Edwards stood by as O.J. leaped into his Bentley and drove off. In the course of his examination, Darden had asked Edwards why he didn't arrest Simpson on the spot. "Because I knew that if I took O.J. Simpson, a person of that stature, to the station in his underwear, that there would be repercussions, because the media would show up and it would be blown out of proportion." Edwards admitted that he didn't even file a complete report of the incident. He omitted, he said, Simpson's statement that he had had sex with one of the women living in the house earlier that day. Why did Edwards leave it out? In part because he didn't think it was relevant, but also because it would just be a sensationalism thing. This deferential police attitude toward Simpson became even more obvious when the next witness, Mike Farrell, the detective in charge of the 1989 domestic violence investigation, took the stand. Farrell's inquiry, such as it was, consisted of calling O.J. on the telephone and then calling Nicole. Farrell's conversation with Nicole appeared to have amounted to the detectives telling the crime victim how she could drop the case against the man who had beaten her. In a manner typical of domestic violence victims, Nicole preferred to get on with her life rather than take her husband to court. Farrell testified, "She said if she could avoid it, she just doesn't want to prosecute." As Farrell admitted on the stand, the only reason he referred the case to the city's attorney's office for prosecution is that the California domestic violence law required him to do so. The coddling of O.J. by the police placed Clark and Darden in an uncomfortable position. In the murder case against Simpson, of course, they were joined with and supportive of the LAPD. But it was clear to all of the prosecutors that the police had horribly bungled the domestic violence matter. In a remarkable footnote to their brief to Judge Ito on the domestic violence issues, the prosecutors made clear their disdain for their ostensible allies. Nicole's feelings of helplessness and belief that the police would not do anything to the defendant were well-founded, they wrote. Members of the West Los Angeles Division of the LAPD frequented defendant's home, often utilizing the pool and tennis courts. When the officers required the appearance of a celebrity at the yearly Christmas party, the defendant eagerly agreed to appear. When the officers desired his autograph on footballs, he responded. In turn, the officers responded to Rockingham in response to Nicole's calls for help 7 to 8 times prior to the 1989 incident. Each time, the defendant was not arrested. However, the true measure of Nicole's isolation came only with the next witness. The lawyers on both sides of the Simpson case often learned as much through the news media as from their own investigators. For example, during jury selection, the prosecutors found out about one witness in Sheila Weller's Raging Heart, one of the instant books that were published in the months after the murders. The opening scene of Weller's book described a conversation between Simpson and a man, whom we will call Leo, in Simpson's bedroom late on the night of June 13th, after Simpson had returned from his trip to Chicago and had been interviewed by the detectives at Parker Center. Simpson told Leo that the police had told him they had found blood in his house. "How long does it take for DNA to come back?" Simpson asked. Leo, who didn't know, guessed 2 months. "They asked me if I would take a lie detector test," Simpson continued, adding that he didn't want to take one. "'Cause," Simpson added with a kind of chuckle, "I have had some dreams of killing her." It didn't take long for the prosecutors to identify Leo as Ron Shipp, a former LAPD officer and longtime friend of O.J.'s. Shipp was a rather typical, if revealing, figure in Simpson's circle of hangers-on. Simpson and Shipp were, on one level, peers, black men of about the same age and background. Shipp had first met Simpson in the 1960s, when his brother played high school football against Simpson. But Simpson became a major figure in Shipp's life in the late 70s, when he was a patrol officer assigned to West Los Angeles. During that period, Shipp would stop by O.J.'s house on Rockingham as often as twice a week, to use the tennis court or just shoot the breeze. In 1982, Shipp was transferred downtown, so he visited the Rockingham House less often, about once a month. Shipp had also served as a kind of counselor for Jason Simpson, O.J.'s troubled son from his first marriage. He spoke to the boy once when O.J. found that Jason had used cocaine, and again when Jason attacked the life-size statue of O.J. by the Rockingham pool with a baseball bat. In more recent years, Shipp had not prospered. He had developed a drinking problem, was suspended from the police force, accepted early retirement in 1989, and then a year later, tried and failed to be reinstated as a cop. His efforts at an acting career met with little success, save one small part on a television program that O.J. helped him get. Even though California law prohibited the prosecution from mentioning the polygraph issue in front of the jury, the prosecutors wanted to call on Shipp to testify about his conversation with O.J. about his dreams of killing Nicole. According to prosecutor Hank Goldberg, the statement would illustrate the defendant's mental state and show his intention at or around the time of the murder. In a later argument on the same issue, Marcia Clark cited Hollywood authority in support of admitting the dream testimony, telling the judge, "Walt Disney said it best, I think, in Sleeping Beauty. A dream is a wish your heart makes." Because Cochran was distantly related to Shipp, Carl Douglas handled the witness for the defense. He urged Ito to exclude Shipp's testimony because, as Douglas put it, dreams are not predictive of events that may have occurred in the past or predictive of things in the future. Evidence about the dream would prove very little, especially divorced from its context in the conversation about the polygraph. Ito weighed the decision whether to allow the dream testimony, and blew it. For all his failings as a judge, Ito handled the hundreds of legal rulings in the case with considerable skill, but he missed on this one. The judge said the dream was admissible. Ito essentially acknowledged this mistake at the end of the trial by instructing the jury to discount the testimony about the dream. Simpson had absorbed the first few days of the trial impassively, occupying himself with doodling or whispering comments to Shapiro on his left or Cochran on his right. When Shipp walked to the witness stand, though, Simpson came alive. He shook his head, muttered beneath his breath, and generally made his contempt unmistakable. After he took the oath, Shipp tried to avoid Simpson's gaze. The former cop appeared a genuinely tortured figure, beholden to Simpson, still admiring of him in some ways, and yet conscience-stricken about what he knew. One could tell how much he enjoyed the days when he could come and go freely through the electric gates at Rockingham, when he had entered a world of privilege and savored his proximity to celebrity. "Did you take officers to the defendant's home?" Darden asked him. "Yes, I did, if I was on patrol. Sometimes I would take people over there. I used to get a kick out of not telling them where I was going and ringing the doorbell and have O.J. come out and greet them." "How many other officers would you say you took to Rockingham?" "Wow. I would have to say approximately maybe 40 guys, maybe." Darden asked if he and Simpson remained friends. "I still love the guy, but, I don't know. I mean, this is a weird situation I'm sitting here in." Shipp had made his love for Simpson evident following the January 1st, 1989 incident with Nicole. 2 days after the beating, Nicole called Shipp, who had some training in domestic violence situations, to talk about what had happened with Simpson. Nicole asked Shipp to talk with O.J. and impress upon him how seriously she regarded the incident. Shipp did talk to Simpson, who was very upset because he thought he was going to lose Hertz and his image was going to be tarnished. Instead of helping Nicole, Shipp went to his supervisors at the West L.A. station and asked that the case against Simpson be dropped. It is possible, then, to summarize Nicole Brown Simpson's experience with the LAPD after her beating in 1989. The officers on the scene let O.J. run off into the night. The detective on the case told her how to drop the charges. Nicole sought help from one police officer she knew, Ron Shipp, and he ran right to O.J. Shipp then went to a supervisor to try to get the charges dropped, and in the end, returned to Nicole to implore her to leave O.J.'s precious image intact. In a trial that resounded with talk of conspiracies within the LAPD, this was, in reality, the only conspiracy. The one to help O.J. Simpson escape prosecution for beating his wife in 1989. Small wonder, then, that in the week before her death, Nicole called a battered women's shelter, not the police, to report that her ex-husband was stalking her. An effective defense cross-examination of Ron Shipp might have consisted of a question or two. Mr. Shipp, do you want to do in your real life everything that you dream about? Do you know, does anyone know, what any specific dream really means? Such an exchange would have communicated quickly to the jury just how much this dream testimony appeared to be worth. Carl Douglas chose another tack, war. In this, he was reflecting the wishes of his client. Simpson was appalled that this hanger-on had turned on him. It upset the natural order of relationships he had lived with and ruled over for decades. The Ron Shipps simply do not do this sort of thing, and if they do, they are punished. Unfortunately for him, Simpson had to deputize the punishment of this lackey to Carl Douglas, who was almost certainly the weakest of the lawyers who appeared regularly in front of this jury. The cross-examination of Ron Shipp turned out to be very different from what the defense had planned. It became a study of celebrity and of power. Indeed, an explanation in microcosm of why O.J. Simpson had murdered his wife and why he thought he could get away with it. Instead of dismissing the dream comment, Douglas built it up. He began his cross-examination of Shipp by asking a long series of questions to establish that the witness had not disclosed the dream conversation in a number of interviews, with the police, with defense investigators, with Douglas himself. Shipp had essentially admitted all of this on direct examination, but then Douglas made a cardinal error. He asked a why question, which allows a witness, in effect, to say anything he wants. Why didn't you tell these people about the dream? Because, Shipp said, I really did not want to be really involved in all of this, and I didn't want to be going down as a person to nail O.J. Suddenly the dream remark wasn't innocuous. It nailed O.J. Unhappy with this answer, Douglas shot back. Well, you're not, so don't worry about that. Clark objected, and Ito scolded Douglas. Counsel, you know better, the judge said. The jury is to disregard counsel's remark. Clark smiled at Douglas's blunder and scribbled a note to Darden. Thank you, Carl. Douglas then set off another series of questions aimed at proving that Shipp had made up the story about the dream. Why didn't he tell the police earlier? Wasn't he just trying to enhance his acting career? Was he acting now, trying to make himself famous? Shipp replied with quiet dignity as the attacks grew harsher. Mr. Douglas, he said at one point, I put all my faith in God and my conscience. Since Nicole's been dead, I've felt nothing but guilt, my own personal guilt, that I didn't do as much as I probably should have. Clark wrote it again. Thank you, Carl. There was some irony in this line of attack, because Douglas and all other lawyers knew that Shipp was almost certainly telling the truth about what he had heard Simpson say. Shipp asserted that his conversation with Simpson took place on late Monday night, June 13th. Just a few hours earlier that day, Simpson had been interviewed by Van Atter and Lang. In the course of that conversation, Lang had asked Simpson whether Weitzman had talked about his taking a polygraph examination. What are your thoughts on that? Lang asked. Should I talk about my thoughts on that? Simpson mused to the detectives. I'm sure eventually I'll do it, but it's like I've got some weird thoughts now. I've had weird thoughts, you know. When you've been with a person for 17 years, you think everything. I've got to understand what this thing is. If it's true blue, I don't mind. When Shipp spoke to Weller, he had no way of knowing what Simpson had said to the police on June 13th. Yet Simpson's comments in the two conversations, to the detectives in the afternoon and to Shipp at night, bore a striking resemblance to one another. The police interview represented strong independent corroboration of Shipp's account. Still, Douglas continued to flog Shipp. He suggested that Simpson, in fact, went to bed at 8 or 8:15 on the night of June 13th. Shipp denied it. Douglas said other family members would confirm the early bedtime. Shipp did something extraordinary at that point. Instead of answering Douglas, he started directing his testimony directly to the defendant. "Is that what they're going to testify to?" he implored his former patron. As Douglas continued to press the issue, Shipp started shaking his head. After a long pause, he stared at Simpson and said simply, "This is sad, O.J." Simpson wasn't used to this kind of confrontation from the likes of Ron Shipp. O.J. looked shaken, rubbing his hands nervously. Shapiro noticed this and put his arm around him, as if in protection. Douglas moved to his big finish for the day. "Were you and he close friends?" "I would say we were pretty good friends," Shipp said. "We never went out to dinner, like, on a regular basis and stuff like that." Douglas seized on the phrase, "regular basis." He pointed out that Shipp and O.J. almost never ate meals together. Shipp readily agreed. In contrast to Douglas's insinuations, Shipp was not trying to protect any false intimacy with O.J. The power of his testimony came from the fact that Shipp knew what a toady he was. He knew he adored and looked up to O.J., and he knew, ultimately, that O.J. couldn't have cared less about him. "O.J. Simpson is a football fan, isn't he?" Douglas asked. "Yeah, he loves football. Yes, he does." "He goes to games a lot." "Yes, he does," Shipp replied. "You and O.J. Simpson have never attended a football game together?"
"Never."
"In the 26 years that he's been your supposed friend, have you?"
"Not one."
"You and your wife have never gone on a double date with Nicole and O.J. Simpson in the entire time that you've known them, have you?" Douglas sneered. "You're absolutely correct," said Shipp. "All the times that you claim that you were over his house playing tennis, you have never in your entire life played tennis on the same court with O.J. Simpson, have you?"
"Never."
Then finally, with disgust, "You're not really this man's friend, are you, sir?" Shipp sighed.
"Well, okay. All right. If you want me to explain it, I guess you can say I was like everybody else, one of his servants. I did police stuff for him all the time. I ran license plates. That's what I was. I mean, like I said, I loved the guy." "Thank you, Carl."
Alrighty. Context of White Supremacy, second audio segment all done. We will pick up next week. What is that, chapter 15? Yes. Oh, my God. We got to the, every week now is the good part. From the trial, from here to the end, every week is a good part because this is what we all are waiting for, the trial. A dirty, filthy word. So next week, Chris Darden gets up to explain the prosecution's stance on why the word nigger should not be allowed at the trial. So I said, this is the case study for counter-racism, the O.J. Simpson trial. Cannot wait. Every week from now till the verdict is cannot wait. OJ Day on the cows. Now, I am including a little bit from Johnny Cochran's book, Journey to Justice, which is not an OJ book. Just about the last third is about OJ Simpson, just to address the portion about Bill Hodgman having health problems and all of that. So this is 285. And he's talking about his opening statements. From there, I moved on through a kind of laundry list of the witnesses we intended to call and a brief summary of the testimony each would offer, along with a thought or two on its significance to our case. The process took much longer than I had anticipated because of the repeated objections, most of them overruled, lodged by Bill Hodgman. some of these objections appeared to be merely tactical, designed to throw me off stride, an unusual maneuver for Bill, who, like Gary Oldman, is one of the courtroom's authentic gentlemen. Others, however, had a firmer basis, since, according to the prosecutors, they had never been given the statements of some witnesses I mentioned, as California's so-called reciprocal discovery statute requires. In essence, that law, which was enacted by popular initiative, requires both sides in a criminal trial to exchange most witness statements before the trial. When Carl had taken over management of the case files from Bob Shapiro's office late in December, he had been assured that the prosecutors had received all the discovery to which they were entitled up to that point. As it turned out, statements and tape-recorded interviews with potentially important witnesses like Rosa Lopez and Mary Ann Gershius had not been turned over. Ito, as the law requires, took a dim view of this and subsequently slapped both Carl and me as the lawyers now in charge with $950 fines. Not one word of apology ever crossed Shapiro's lips about the embarrassing position in which he had left us, but he did confess sometime later. "You know, I just don't understand those discovery laws." He was, however, well-schooled in self-preservation. Within a few days, we watched him scuttle in and out of Judge Ito's chambers by himself before court convened. "What were you doing in there, Bob?" I asked suspiciously. "Oh," he said, "I found a few more things we hadn't turned over, so I gave them to Ito." "You did what?" I demanded. "Bob, don't you think before you go off covering your own backside, you ought to tell us and our client what you have before you turn it over to the prosecution? What was it? What did you give them?" "I'm not quite sure. There were a bunch of things," he said, hurried and rattled, as he always seemed to be whenever push came to shove during the trial. I looked over at the long-suffering Carl, whose eyes were wide with helpless horror. Fortunately, whatever Shapiro turned over that day, it must have been of little consequence because we heard nothing more about it. There was a great deal of discussion in the days that followed about what transpired on the 18th floor of the criminal court's building on the evening following the first day of my opening statement. My friend Bill Hodgman had appeared unwell all through his uncharacteristically contentious performance that day. I knew how carefully Garcetti was monitoring the proceedings and that nearly every evening he and his senior assistants insisted on meeting with their trial team. The group, as several of the prosecutors repeatedly complained to us, invariably included Gill's media advisor, a former television news personality named Susan Childs. She was known by some in the office as Deputy Bubbles. That night, the entire prosecution team was ordered to Gill's private conference room, where a tense and apparently angry discussion ensued of the team's performance that day. At some point, Hodgman, by then visibly ill, excused himself, went to another office, and collapsed. Some accounts have alleged that when we were informed officially of his illness the next day, we congratulated each other. That is false and grotesque. Bill Hodgman was and is my friend. He is the only Simpson prosecutor to whom I still regularly speak. I tried to reach his wife as soon as I learned of Bill's collapse, and our office sent him flowers as soon as we learned where he was recovering. Thankfully, his illness, apparently induced by stress, passed quickly, though he never really returned to the courtroom during the O.J. Simpson trial. After a delay, I wrapped up my opening statement with a blaze of the wonderfully illustrative charts and visual aids Bob Blazier had so skillfully prepared. Displayed together, they gave the jury a schematic view of the story we were about to unfold for them. I was accustomed to trying complex civil cases where such demonstrative evidence
is a normal part of one's presentation. In criminal trials, only the most accomplished advocates tend to employ such powerful storytelling props, and even they are frequently constrained by their clients' finances. In this case, we labored under no such limits, primarily due to Bob Blazier's ability to turn out these amazing charts and graphs. Those graphics seem to have an even bigger impact on the prosecutors than they did on the jury. As the chart came down and I turned from the podium to walk back to my seat, I glanced at the prosecutors, and for the first time, I saw fear, real fear, in their eyes. Maybe, guys, I chuckled silently to myself, this isn't going to be a slam dunk after all. I will stop there. He goes into the abuse and all that good stuff. Anywho, that is Johnny Cochran, Johnny L. Cochran Jr., Journey to Justice. Number is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. If you did not get to participate the first time around and have commentary to share, get your hand up right now. Do not wait until the end if you have commentary to share. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, Kyle's listeners, and hello, the guest Gus. I just wanted to make a comment on Jeffrey Toobin's comment about Chris Darden and Johnny Cochran's relationship, like some of the banter that they were doing during the court. It sounds like a lot of it is a lot what Mr. Fuller talks about in terms of the tragic arrangement that non-white people have between each other, that it's rather tacky, trashy, and terroristic. And it sounds like a lot of what Jeffrey Toobin was describing was actually that. And then he also kind of romanticized Nicole Kidman and demonized O.J. Simpson, and making it seem like he had some kind of black privilege, you know, which really doesn't exist. And I think that's it. Thank you.
Much obliged, sir. They had, I think that happened before. Nicole Brown Simpson, Nicole Kidman, popular white female actress, suspected racist, Nicole Brown Simpson. But yes, tacky, trashy, and terroristic. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Henry in Chicago? Yes, sir.
Toobin, once again, trying to, building the case towards domestic violence about from O.J. Simpson, still doesn't prove that he murdered, so he's still on that. He also has a contempt for black women as well. I noticed in his description of the, I guess it was the 911 operator, Gilbert, he said that she was a rotund and good-natured black woman. Rotund, just a nice word of calling somebody fat. So, yeah, he has something against black women for some reason. Well, obviously he's a racist, but he's basically blaming black women as well for freeing OJ, I guess. But and also too, he said that Ito missed an opportunity when he found the dream testimonies by Ron Shipp as inadmissible. And I am not a lawyer at all, but I'm pretty sure that describing dreams from someone else sounds kind of crazy, and that proves nothing in a court of law because you're trying to deal with the facts. So I don't know what he missed when he said that when he deemed the evidence or the testimony as inadmissible. I mean, you describing dreams of someone else's, that is just nonsense if you're going to really legitimize that as hardcore evidence. So, and Toobin should know better. This guy's a lawyer. I mean, these are Harvard lawyers, so he should know better. But, you know, like I said, I'm he's being racist. So, but that's all I have right now in my life.
Dreams, Dr. King. Let's see. Other folks with a hand up, any other commentary on the second portion of the audio?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, continue to see this type of, between questions, what Toobin is writing, like how he's writing towards Darden, about Darden and Cochran is just so, it's really fascinating. What he's doing, he's perpetuating that, you know, see, look at these two niggas, you know, you see how they can't get along and they're always fighting amongst each other. And he perpetuates the same stereotype in his writing and playing. And then at the same time, like really, I mean, doubling down, I don't know if that's even a metaphor, but just making sure it's understood that Christopher Darden is incompetent. Like he's really trying to stress that and get it across more than anything else in this writing. And it's just, damn, like this dude is taking a beating on almost every level, like in the courtroom, outside the courtroom. Like, I don't even know how he's walking around in the streets after this, but I'm just saying, like, from what I'm reading, he's taking a real approach of really causing a lot of friction between two non-white people, specifically black males, as they always have done. The real thing that I'm kind of wondering now is how does he fit? Because I haven't gone ahead, but I'm wondering, does he fit the other, all the quote unquote people on that enter the stand? Do they all get into this book, or is it probably going to be cut up a little bit and he's not going to have everybody in there? Because this is based off the series from the movie, it's definitely going to get cut off. But one of the questions I have, but really interesting how he's taken that stance against with Darden and with Cochran, just having them pit against each other like two dogs or something like that. But that's it. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, sir. Again, I suspect either this book will not have all of the witnesses who took the stand. I just can't imagine how that would be possible, and or it will be greatly reduced. I just can't imagine. I mean, the dozens and dozens of people who testified, it would just be, I mean, Dennis Fung alone, I think he was on the stand for like 2 weeks. We'll have to see how much detail gets included, but it will be way more than the FX series, like way more. It's already made more information than the FX series is in the text as we go. Let's see. Let me include one of our investors wrote in for chapter 14. Thank you, Carl. Darden made his bizarre profession of love for Cochran. Mr. Darden was way out of his league from the very start of the trial, and I suspect he knew it. He had not been like in the courtroom doing a lot of like trial work as an attorney like previous, not saying he'd never done it, but just like in the few months and like year or two leading up to the Simpson case, I don't think he had been doing like a ton of intense trial work at that time. I could be in error, but I don't think that was the case. Yeah. Number two, regarding New Year's Day altercation, Cochran had a grenade in his pocket that he declined to use. John Edwards had been named one of the 44 officers identified by the Christopher Commission as part of the problem of a problem group within LAPD. 37 of 44 L.A. police officers identified as problem officers by the Christopher Commission have received counseling and retraining, according to a report submitted to the police commission. The remainder were either fired or reassigned from the force. Los Angeles Times, December 12, 1992. Problem officers were defined as having repeated six or more complaints of brutality. That seems like a high threshold. So if you had five, you're good. You're not a problem officer. All righty. Christopher, I said, L.A. riots, Rodney King, very, very relevant to this case. Comes up so many times, so many different ways. They even make a casual reference to the Christopher Commission in the FX series. They don't get into a whole lot of detail. It's just kind of a offhanded, you know, response, and then they continue on. Let's see. I'll share a few of my notes on the second portion that we read. When they talk about Bill Hodgman leaving the team, I don't think his presence would have made a difference. He could not have made up for the goofy evidence or lack thereof evidence in the case. He couldn't have made up for Mark Furman. He couldn't have made up for the timeline issues. Bill Hodgman, he could have been there or not. They're still going to take an L. Incidentally, though, I did, at least in my view, making it seem like Bill Hodgman died as a result of Johnny Cochran and Carl Douglas's misconduct, I thought was really lame. If you are in this age group, I think he was in his 40s at the time. If you are not in the best health, and they said this was stressful, all of the cameras and press and nightly meetings, he even testified. In fact, you can look, you can see the day in court that he had the whatever heart issue that evening. You can see the day in court where he's talking to Judge Ito, and he says, "I'm not sure when I'm going to get home." He said that they'd had lots of nights of working really late, so you're not getting adequate rest, you're not sleeping correctly. You could end up having health issues with that sort of thing. That's not Johnny Cochran's fault and some nefarious doings of these Negro attorneys. Like, come on. And so then he says, after Hodgman leaves, the shift in mood was immediately apparent. Addressing Judge Ito about the discovery violations, Clark and Darden immediately became unhinged. True, the defense had engaged in rather cynical misconduct, but in the context of a long trial, the withholding of a few witness statements was probably not going to amount to much. After they just made it like, oh, this big deal, and this is probably what led to Hodgman having heart. Come on. He says, what should have mattered more to the prosecution was simply getting the case underway and its witnesses on the stand. Instead, for several hours, Clark and Darden ranted. And now with Darden, this is consistent using this sort of language, that Darden is a child. Black people are boys and girls. But Clark, she will, again, just be regarded as arrogant. She doesn't get, you know, talked about as being incompetent. At least Tubin doesn't describe her in that way. Others do and say that she was incompetent in the way that she handled the prosecution's case. Let's see. Next. Just describing Darden's behavior as strange, erratic, the way he talked about. Now, I do think Christopher Darden had a lot of respect for Johnny Cochran going into this. I think that was probably true, in terms of the admiration that he had for him as kind of someone to look up to in the profession, right? Like, oh, wow, this is someone who, you know, I aspire to be like, and that type of thing. Johnny Cochran had worked in his same position as a prosecutor before. So I think all of that was totally legitimate. And I think he, like, jokingly referred to him as like a stepdad type of figure. So I think all of that is totally legitimate, even though that is kind of, I don't know if this particular trial, if this is the moment to divulge all of that publicly. Let's see. Let's see. The point where he talks about he mentioned the 911 call. I would say absolutely, with the way that he talks about the jurors, the mostly black female jurors, and certainly the way that he talks about the 911 call answer responder. Sharon Gilbert, describing her as a rotund and good-natured black woman. Like, I feel like we're talking about like Gone with the Wind or Hattie McDaniel. Like, what in the world? I've seen and heard many other folks testify to her and talk about her. No one else. Yes, our first witness for the prosecution, a rotund black woman. Like, nobody, just Sharon Gilbert, 911 dispatch operator. Yes, what's your testimony? Wow, harrowing. Mm-hmm. Beatings. Okay. Jeff Toobin. Let's see. I do appreciate Toobin including the information about Edwards, even though Cochran didn't bring this up on the trial. Definitely appreciate that. Just in my view, it shows how widespread the Mark Furmans are in the police department. This is not a one-time or an anomalous thing. Let's see. The whole Mark Marcel ship, I thought, for so many components, when they talk about him, O.J. Simpson, coming back and asking, hey, how long does it take for DNA to come back? I do not find anything incriminating or nefarious about that. O.J. Simpson volunteered his blood to police on June 13th, hours after the murders. So if I volunteered my blood, I might be curious. If I have a police pal or someone who's knowledgeable about blood tests, how long does it take for the results to come back? What type of timetable are we talking about? Like, man, any sort of information I can get. Now, you know, if that doesn't seem logical to you, fine. To me, that seems totally legit. I would ask. The dream component, I immediately thought of Dr. Tommy Curry. We talked about that before. Black people, invariably black males, but black people who end up being convicted of some sort of really serious crime because of some sort of dream. Where you've had black males convicted, where a white person said, oh, well, the face of the black rapist came to me in a dream, and it was this fella. And that was enough. No eyewitness, no DNA, no evidence to incriminate, just face came to me in a dream, and it was you. Guilty. O.J. Simpson said he had dreams of killing Nicole. Guilty. Like, what? Like, interesting. Okay. But, are you serious? Like, you're going to waste that time on a trial? Like, we have to evaluate the, worthiness of dream. And I mean, why not bring in some astrologists? I mean, come on. Let's see. This gets a lot. I guess this is truth school. Now, he talked about that last week, that Judge Ito is, in terms of his style of operating a courtroom, is true school. You just let all the information in, and that way the jury has access, and then they can make a decision. They can sort through the information themselves. Is it true? Is it reliable? That sort of thing. But truth school, let all the information in. Keep that in mind when we get to the Furman tapes. Dreams, all right, let that in. Keep that in mind, and particularly if we're about true school, let all the evidence in, and the jury, you know, they can evaluate for themselves, make sense of it. Next, he says, oh my God, and they justify the dreams. Marsha Clark cited Hollywood Authority in support of admitting the dream testimony, telling the judge, Walt Disney said it best, I think in Sleeping Beauty, a dream is a wish your heart makes. That's what I mean. We're in a trial where O.J. Simpson could have got the death penalty, and we're using fairy tales to justify dream interpretation that says O.J. did it. This is what I have believed for, what is it now, 25 years, encroaching on 26. Oh, yeah, O.J. did it. Dreamed about killing her. You know, in Disney, they say the dream. Come on. Let's see. And then you let all the dream stuff in and then come back later on and tell them a month down the road. Matter of fact, forget about all that dream stuff. That was a bunch of nonsense. Just forget about all that. Come on. Let's see. Man for Counter-Racist Lesson. This, I do not have any evidence, right? I'm just submitting there is one theory, one group who says, hey, for these shoe prints that they say, even though they never step forward to say, hey, O.J. Simpson owned these Bruno Magli shoes to make these prints and what have you, they never step forward to conclusively prove that these gloves were O.J. Simpson's. I said, man, that O.J. Simpson, you just heard from Ship. Hey, he had people come over and play on the tennis court. He had people come over and go swimming and all that and come hang out at the house. Ship said he was asked, hey, did you take patrol officers by? Oh, yeah, we would go. I wouldn't even tell. He talks about this in the ESPN documentary. Oh, yeah, we would go by. They would get a kick out of it. I wouldn't even tell him that we were going to OJ's house. We would just get there and, oh, my God, the Jews and blah, blah, blah. He would autograph footballs and all. They said, well, how many officers would you say you took to Rockingham? Wow. I would have to say approximately maybe 40 guys. Whoa. Whoa. Now, he didn't say Mark Furman was one of the 40 guys. But if the Christopher Commission, now I just told you the threshold was you had to have six reports of unnecessary force, racial bias, and all the rest of it. So if you got five reports, you're not a problem officer. You're good. Counseling, retraining, no problem. If 40 officers went by O.J. Simpson's house, is it possible any of those 40 could have been one of these problem officers? Possible any of them could have been similar to Mark Furman? If so, if you have any folks who have an inclination, there are folks who say, man, it would seem like enough people would have access to O.J. Simpson's residence. And it seems you just heard O.J. Simpson, philanthropist. He's given away the Porsche. He got a Porsche for his wife and is taking care of her whole family. Got them set up with all these Hertz businesses and everything. He was known to giving away like clothing and stuff. He had all these sponsorships. He would give out a lot of this stuff to the police officers and things in the area. Athletes, you know, they get all the Nike gear and that sort of stuff. Is it possible many of these visitors and hangers on, toad people as he describes them, is it possible that some of them could have just grabbed a pair of gloves from O.J. Simpson's house? Grabbed a pair of shoes from O.J. Simpson's house and then just had this stuff to use for this crime and leave it there and or had this stuff and then has have it to plant there. Is that possible? Maybe, maybe not. You can think for yourself. I will say just my understanding of counter-racist logic, according to the Christopher Commission, we use their evidence. If you've got that many problem officers, do I think it's wise to have 40 police officers in my residence as a black male, especially a feverish black male known for courting white women? Probably not. Next, when he talks about the 1989 incident and saying that it was a conspiracy and you had everyone helping to keep O.J. Simpson from being prosecuted, and Ship steps in to say, hey, Nicole, don't prosecute. And the other officer is talking to her and, hey, Nicole, this is a way, you know, if you want to drop the case, this is how you can do it and all that. And the officer even who pressed the charges said that he legally had to do it. He didn't want to do it again. According to Jeffrey Toobin, what we read way back earlier in the book, the only reason O.J. Simpson has a conviction for this 1989 incident is because Mark Furman wrote a report to say, oh, yeah, I think this is a problem. I've been out there before. If Mark Furman, according to Toobin's own account, if Mark Furman had not written that letter, there would be no 1989 conviction. And that's the only incident of physical abuse that they have in this whole big case, the 1989 incident. Incidentally, the 1985 incident where Mark Furman was the responding officer. And even imagine that. Now, how is it? Every time you have a responding officer, it's always someone who has a history of white terrorism in their police file. Like, ooh, problem officer. And ooh, this is someone who admitted to being a racist and tried to get a pension because of his racist and homicidal tendencies. How is that that is always the type of officer who is responding to the Simpson residents? Anyway, he talks about the 85 incidents where there was no physical violence. Mark Furman shows up. He says O.J. Simpson had a baseball bat, has beaten this car, and he goes in, put that bat down, O.J. He describes it in detail, the ESPN documentary. Now, if you have a black male with a baseball bat beating a car, which he owns, and a trembling white woman, and it's Mark Furman, are you telling me there's no way that this doesn't go down as a report? All it takes is Nicole saying, nah, I'm good. All right. And he just walks away. That's it. I guess, how believable do I think that is? Do I think Mark Furman was starstruck and so in love, enthralled, he worshipped O.J. Simpson, that seeing a black male with a baseball bat and a trembling white woman? Yeah. Yeah, it's the juice. I'll let it ride. Maybe. Or maybe it was not, in fact, domestic terrorism. Maybe he was not, in fact, going to kill Nicole Brown Simpson with a baseball bat. Maybe that's not what he saw. Come to your own conclusions. Let's see. Yeah, I don't. He gives the whole assessment of the how Carl Douglas questions Shipp in this. And I think lots of folks felt like, oh, man, this is a great day for the prosecution. If you go back and look at the way it was covered. I do not exactly see. He says that this was the explanation of O.J. Simpson's behavior, him being all nervous, shifting in his seat when all this has happened, especially when Shipp talks to him like, man, O.J., this is sad that, you know, you all questioning me in this manner. He says that this is an explanation in a microcosm of why O.J. Simpson had murdered his wife and why he thought he could get away with it in terms of him just having control and star power and people don't question him. That is quite a bit of a stretch for me. I would think if you have all of these really powerful attorneys, F. Lee Bailey and everyone else working with Carl Douglas, the defense strategy would not be O.J. Simpson is upset or feels jaded, I guess, betrayed by Shipp. And so he's going to instruct his lawyers to operate in an aggressive and combative fashion with a witness. I think they're going to say, no, OJ, we know how to operate a defense. We'll listen to your intake or what have you, what you think about this guy and all that. But I would think F. Lee Bailey, these guys, we've been doing this a while. We know how to construct, you know, question a witness. Anywho, let's see. Anything else from this chapter? I thought it was important as well. He described Shipp as toady. I think that is a racial slur for black people. Sometimes black people would be referred to as toads, frogs. I have to go back and check the racial slur index, but I am very sure toad and or frog is one of them. Either way, it's name calling. Lots of name calling of black people throughout the trial. Lots of name calling. And I guess I'll end there with Shipp. He, like Christopher Darden, O.J. Simpson, and Johnny Cochran, all were accused of being feverish. I think that even became a part of the questioning on the stand from Carl Douglas, that Shipp, in addition to being an alcoholic, which he was and admitted to, but you were hanging out in the jacuzzi with these white women. You're not really O.J. Simpson's friend. You're just some lackey, attention-getting guy and out hanging out with all these white women. It's just, I'm just mentioning that because I just, it is... what to say, resounding the number of times that a black male is accused of being feverish within this case. Witnesses, attorneys, the defendant, it's astounding. Maybe even some of the jurors, I don't know, but definitely Johnny Cochran, Darden, O.J. Simpson, and Mr. Shipp. With that, we miss anybody? Any folks have any comments to get in before we wrap up? Oh, missed one. Caller in Texas. Last four digits, 0658. 0658, did you have commentary? Are you just listening?
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Gus, this is Alex in Austin. I just, I don't know about the toad, but you know, I'm thinking about, I remember the frog prince, and there's the thing about kissing a frog and turning to a prince. So there's probably something there deep back and the archetypes. But I was thinking about the image of the sun with the baseball bat to the statue. That was an interesting inclusion on the author's choice. And it's just an interesting image that's kind of sticking with me and thinking about kind of the impotence of it, like hitting a statue. I don't know, maybe I missed something in the previous chapters, but, you know, hitting a statue, and the sports metaphors are there with the baseball bat, seemingly impotent, kind of like, but also playing on the, you know, the black man as unkillable, unhurtable, as monster, as machine. And, but then coupled with, you know, finally the scene of the crime, as it were, and the kind of more soft textures, and then whatever the implications of the first son, according to that, you know, I'm not sure if that's the line the author is drawing, but it's just that image of the baseball bat to the statue is sticking with me. But thanks. Awesome, awesome show. Thank you.
Much obliged. Much obliged. That is in a number of reports, both contemporaneously and even like that you'll see now, like 2021, that talk about this event or what have you. Because sometimes some of the theories will say, oh, well, maybe Jason Simpson, OJ's son from his first marriage with Marguerite, maybe he did the murders. Maybe he, you know, killed these people. And they'll say, yeah, he's got a violent record, and he got that baseball bat and beat the statue that one time. Like, that'll be one, in my view, at least, one of the wacky theories about this case. I think he had a pretty good alibi for that evening, and, you know, police could have tried. I think the police had him under investigation during all of this as well, surveillance. So I'm pretty sure they would have charged him or whatever the case if they had any inkling of evidence or suspicion that he might have been involved or an accomplice. But yeah, I'm sure that for a lot of folks, like, oh man, like father, like son, you took that baseball bat to the statue, just like OJ took that baseball bat to the car. You know, they learn all that violence, the toxic black males. You gotta watch. But yeah, folks can keep that in mind. And his son, Jason Simpson, is frequently at the trial. You can kind of see the folks for the defense generally on the right side, sitting behind OJ. So you can generally, he'll be on the front row, Jason Simpson. We nabbed everybody. Folks, good. Grand. We will be here tomorrow. Again, pretty much everything from now to the end of the book. It's no more need for speculation, or I don't even really need footnotes for everything that's being discussed now to the conclusion of the book, because it's on Court TV. So you can go to YouTube, you can watch the entire opening statement of Johnny Cochran, you can watch the entire opening statement that Chris Darden gave, and judge for yourself, does he sound incompetent? Does he sound like he knows what he's talking about? Same thing for Johnny Cochran. You can hear how he's being interrupted. And in fact, as I said, Bill Hodgman, you can hear where he gets up. He's having some problems speaking. Like, people were already saying, like, man, he doesn't look too good. Something's wrong with him. He's having problems stuttering and what have you. And Judge Ito says, man, you don't look too good. Maybe take a few moments, get your breath together. And that's sort of like, you can hear the lead up to him having this heart issue and all that. All of this is online. So anything, if you want to check it out, if you want to see Ship's testimony and the exchange, man, OJ, this is sad and all that, hear him talk about the dream, go to YouTube. All this is readily accessible. You can watch it unedited and come to your own opinions. And they pan the camera, so it'll be zoomed in. Like, if they have a specific witness, the 911 dispatcher, Ms. Gibbons, or whoever it is, Gibson, you can see them, and then they'll pan the camera. So they'll pan sometime. You can see the Goldman family. You can see the Simpsons. You can see OJ and how they're responding, all that. Fascinating. If you're interested in watching, it is captivating viewing, to say the least. We will be here tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, neutralizing workplace racism, the COVID-19 situation, the riots, lots to chat on. We'll be here Saturday, the compensatory call-in, Sunday for the Global Sunday Talk on Racism, and then Monday we'll have a white woman with us to talk about health, white supremacy, dairy consumption, all, or All of the programs are normal time except for the Sunday Global Talk. That is at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. That said, much obliged for everyone's participation. Hope it was worthy of your Thursday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We heard so many folks being accused and admonished for their consumption of narcotics. Mr. Shipp ended up, I think, having problems on the force because of his alcohol consumption, and Faye Resnick and all the rest of it. Sobriety would be best. Let's preserve our brain computer. I would encourage hunkering down. Violent days, we're on high alert. Military presence in the D.C. area. Lots of reasons to want to be safe right now, in addition to the Rona. If you have to go out, be very alert, very aware of your surroundings. If it looks like any folks are being loud, rowdy, volatile, this outing is done. This is not a time for verbal confrontations with strangers. You should be assuming these folks are probably armed. And in fact, these folks might have a whole cadre that I can't even see of other people who are also armed. That is not a time for taking unnecessary risks. Anything that looks like it is escalating, out of here. If you need to call the enforcement officers, whatever it is, do so as you are exiting the area. We are very risk avoidance in the midst of all this chaos. So we're sober, hunkering down if possible. If you're going out, you are buckled, driver or passenger. If you're driving, you're not on the cell phone. Just doing the small things that we can to avoid the Mark Furmans of the known universe. And we need all of our attention. Let's be aware of what's happening around us. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.